I'm not pro-Disney.
I didn't get.
Well, you know, Disney has such a cut.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, June 14th special, regular meeting of the GPAC committee. Is this special? That's what I thought. I thought it was special. This is regular. It's always special when we're almost all here. We're missing Melanie today. And we will start with a moment of silence. Thank you. And next we have the Pledge of Allegiance. We do have a flag right behind us here.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, next up we have GPAC announcements. Does anybody have an announcement? No? Bunch of quiet people today, and we have no presentations. We do have a public comment period, and I see one member of the public who is indicating that he doesn't want to talk to us.
Can I save it for later if I choose?
I think we could make that happen just for you. Yeah, okay. Moving on to the consent calendar, we had nothing on consent, unfinished business none, so we'll go right into new business with Michael Baker.
Hello. There we go. Hi, everyone. We are today going to continue with our third meeting on the draft of Plan Morro Bay. So I'll quickly give us a short update. Here's our agenda. And it's hard to see, but basically, following today, we should be continuing into the Planning Commission and then the City Council reviewing the draft plan. On the zoning code next week, Martha Miller will be here from Lisa Weiss Consulting to talk to you about the proposed zoning map as well as Module 4 of the zoning code update, and that's the final module that you haven't seen yet. And the draft environmental impact report is also still in process. So just to remind us, we got through all of the blueprint as of last meeting, and we looked at the introduction to the green print, and next up is the conservation element. So I will take the same approach today as I did last time, where we introduce an element and then have discussion. Just a reminder that the implementation actions for each element are in Section 5 in the table in that section. So if you have comments about those implementation actions, it's great if you want to discuss those as we go through each element. So in the conservation element, we have an overview of the element, the approach to resiliency addressed in this element. We have some key issues. Those include biological communities, air quality, greenhouse gas emissions, water resources and conservation, energy resources, waste management, visual resources and view sheds, and I'm going to come back to this slide, just get through all the key issues, coastal resources and then other resources, which includes a few things. And then we have the goals and policies for the element. We did want to draw your attention specifically to one of the policies under visual resources and view sheds, and this is on page 4-42. It's policy C-8.9. And this has to do with undergrounding. We have discussed undergrounding of utilities as we've gone through the project. It was one of the key issues. It was part of the key issues paper, and there have been a couple different ways that it's been approached in some of the draft documents. We're looking for your input on this policy. We're looking for your input on all of the policies. But this one, we want to make sure you notice, and if you have thoughts on it, we would really appreciate them. And I want to read you the actual text. Thank you. So this one is titled Signage Infrastructure and Utility Requirements, and it reads, encourage signage, infrastructure, and utilities that do not block or detract from views of scenic vistas. The long-term goal shall be to place all overhead utilities underground. When possible, new development shall have utilities placed underground and outside of public view. If undergrounding isn't possible, an in-lieu fee shall be paid towards future undergrounding. So with that, we can talk about that policy or anything else in the conservation element.
That was my question. Okay, is that on now? Okay, all right. Where did you go? Up here. Okay, thank you. Okay. Anyway, it seems like there should be, in terms of a policy, to have all utilities underground, even the current utilities. Either, I would say some reference to cost, cost effectiveness, and even, let's say, if there's underwire or facilities that are not blocking any view, or low density areas, or so. I don't know. It just seems like, you know, a blanket statement like everything should go underground. We can barely keep the streets repaired, you know, much less underground everything. So it seems like maybe setting priority. I know you can't do too much detail in one thing like this, but, you know, maybe, again, some reference to cost effective or where they're impactful or something might be in order.
But doesn't it say that in here when it's? I'm not on. Okay. Doesn't it say that in here where it says that the long-term goal will be to place them when possible, and if undergrounding isn't possible, an in-lieu fee will be paid?
Well, so this is reference. The last two sentences reference new development. They say where possible, new development shall have utilities underground and outside of view, and if undergrounding is impossible, an in-lieu fee. But the statement of long-term goal should be to place all overhead utilities underground seems to me, unless I'm misinterpreting this, to mean all utilities, even current utilities.
So the question is, how do you get current overhead underground?
Well, and maybe there's some that is not cost effective to do that with, or maybe it's not blocking a view, or it's not, you were talking about visual resources here, it's not in the way, it's not, I mean, you know, that kind of thing. So it's some idea of either cost or impact, rather than just a blanket statement that everything should be underground. That'd be also incredibly expensive, obviously. I think everyone knows that.
And I think when you get into the in-lieu fees, you're adding a big cost onto development in a time when development's already expensive, and so we want to be careful that we're not discouraging people from coming in with development. So
I guess in some instances it could. Like for residential development, you're probably talking about undergrounding drops to the house and those types of things. When you're talking about larger development, then it could be things across the frontage. But, you know, some of that stuff the city doesn't have any control over. You know, like PG&E won't do individual drops on properties for anything that's 12 kV and above. They're like, yeah, you have to do a whole block or something like that because they don't want the lines running down the poles, right? Because if your car runs into it, that can be dangerous, and this is one of the reasons. And then we do get some money, you know, from the state to do undergrounding, but it's not enough to do much of anything. We had a project planned over on Beach, and we were looking at our money, and we were looking at getting plans done to do it, and it ended up being so expensive, we're looking at selling the credits now for it.
So if you did it this way and had in-lieu fees, who would be able to access those fees?
Well, the city could collect them and underground them individually down the street or those types of things. What happens is if you put, so a lot of times a project will come forward and it'll have a condition to say to underground it, but sometimes you can't. You know, like you can't, you know, like it's not really feasible, or you have to go three blocks up, you have to go two blocks up or a block and a half up, and it just becomes very expensive, like you're saying, and then the development wouldn't be able to carry forward. So if you come forward with in-lieu fees, then it takes a look at, hey, what's the practicality of undergrounding those lines into the site. A lot of times you can have them do a combination of in-lieu fees and then putting the conduit in that at least brings the drop in again into the site there or what have you. There's a lot of, it would require Public Works developing a plan would be kind of the implementation piece to that. An example, when I was in Pismo, we used to require to have this condition on all projects. And you have to underground on your frontage, but sometimes the pole's across the street. You know, like, okay, and then if you're undergrounding, can you do that, or is it going up the street? And you're like, well, it's probably a little beyond the scope of the project that's there for the addition you're doing to the building. And so that kept happening, and so at one point the Planning Commission was kind of looking at us like, hey, you keep requiring this, and then you're not making them do it. And like, try to explain it, and they're like, well, that's pretty ineffective. Mm-hmm. Why not use, you know, start collecting in-lieu fees for it so they can cost it out and provide money, and then you can do a whole block. And so over time, we were able to do that. We were able to accumulate funds on a couple of different streets, more in the downtown, where we had a lot of development take place, and we were able to do undergrounding of all the utilities down the street, or most of them, and made a huge difference. It looked like spaghetti, you know, and it was just everywhere, and we were able to remove much of the lines on the street we were doing when we kind of finished some of the bigger projects that were on that street. So it was effective. So that's what we'd be looking at here, I think. It sort of tells us to go do that other piece, because right now we do the same thing. In Morro Bay, we tell people you're supposed to underground, and they come in, and they're like, can't underground. And then we're like, oh, okay, because we don't have any in-lieu fee in place for them to pay. It'd be good if we did, because then we could, you know, look to be doing it, you know, more holistically.
Mm-hmm. Scott, that's on. I can't remember the program, but in San Diego County we had with SDG&E, there was a program that there was money accumulated to pay undergrounding, and we would ask about it. I remember for the city, they would say, we're X amount of years behind with that money, but there was a fund available. Mm-hmm. Does PG&E have that type of fund?
We do. And that's
I forgot the name of it. But
that's what I was talking about over on Beach. We had a project that was going in there, but we didn't have any money to carry it off, and construction costs had gotten so expensive when we kind of teed it up to do it. And what happens is, if you have the project and it's ready to go and it's in the queue to get it done, mm-hmm. and you don't carry it out, then they start penalizing you. And so it starts drawing down the credits that we have put in place, and they're a commodity that you can sell, and so the cities look to do that. And there was actually interest. We got interest from actually the city of Pismo Beach wanted to buy it because they're doing a whole streetscape improvement project on Shell Beach Road. We didn't sell it to them because they were really trying to low bid us. And so we looked at some other folks that were willing to actually double what they were willing to pay. So
I thought you'd said state for that, so that's why I was asking.
Oh, I'm
about
sorry. No, it's PG&E.
It's PG&E. And right. The other comment I have on this is that when possible, new development, is that going to include individual units, new houses?
That would be
or that's already on the books, you said.
That would be the idea. So this would.
So not just a development as an attract or something. It would be any type of new development then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
I wonder, Scott. Also, would it be possible maybe to use some of those in lieu funds as a kind of a subsidy? Say, a block of homeowners. Mm-hmm. Wanted to do it, but it was very expensive, and then if they could tap into some of those in-lieu fees.
Yeah, I mean, the in-lieu fee thing is sort of a long-term project there, because you know it's the idea is you take the in-lieu fees in and you want to allocate the undergrounding in the area where you collected the fees. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to like, oh, we're going to collect it over here in North Morro Bay and then go underground down in downtown or something. That would be inappropriate.
Yep.
So you come up with a policy that kind of lays out how you do it, where you do it, and a lot of times you'll come up with areas where that money can be spent and allocate it that way. That's typically how it works.
And was there any thought into, rather than just new developments, but significant remodels of somebody's 50-60% of a home remodel?
Usually we haven't... you're aware, when we go to Planning Commission, we haven't typically had conditions on projects when they were doing an addition to underground the utilities necessarily. Although it's been inconsistently applied, I'll admit that, over time. I have seen some applications in the past that have had that. I just don't think we do it currently. I haven't seen it. No, okay, just making sure. Cindy?
I think you'd have to think about whether it makes sense if they're not changing anything. Like, if they have to change the location of the service, then I think you'd have some grounds for doing it. If they're just leaving it the way it is, I don't know what the grounds would be to make them underground.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you want to have them over time. If you have, you know, they come in and they demo the smaller house that's there, and you have them drop the line and bring it in, at least you're getting the drops that, you know, when you're looking down the street, your street, and you see all of the, you know, utility poles out in the right of way or even behind your house, depending on where you live. You know, as you get rid of those drops that are going like that all the way down, then it improves the look of the neighborhood, regardless of whether it's in your front yard or your backyard, even if you were to leave the pole and the main runs up. So there are certainly, you know, it's a little bit of a mixed bag when we do it, but, I mean, it will, over time, improve, you know, the visual, you know, component of the city, I think. That's what it's intended to do, anyway.
So I guess the question is, how big are these in-lieu fees going to be?
I don't know exactly what the number will be. It'll be based on, predicated on the amount that they need to underground for the project. So it would be, usually it's across the front, so it's the width of your property,
yeah,
and then it's the drop in. And so they would have to go have an engineering analysis done and tell us what that is, and then that would be the amount or some portion thereof that they would be paying to the city.
So the short answer is that it's going to increase the cost of building a house.
It will. So the issue comes in. We already conditioned the projects to do it.
Yeah.
It's just if it's not feasible, then they don't have to do it.
Right.
We should have a better system than that. We should have a system that says, hey, okay, if it's not feasible, great. Then you just need to pay for the, you know, what it would cost to do it in your area. And so it can be sometimes they do the drop into their property and that's all done, and then they just need to pay the money for the portion that would cover the frontage, and then you get a few of those together, and then maybe you have the ability to underground a section of street or what have you. So
I know that some people in my neighborhood were trying to do this years ago, and it's enormously expensive.
And so,
So they found it was very difficult to organize, even if there were a few people willing to do it. There's gaps. There's always gaps because there's got to be some contribution from somebody else. So it was very tricky to get it done. You'd need quite a lot of money in this fund, or you would never get any projects done. And that means the fees have to be pretty stiff.
So I'll give you an example. Again, back to my days in Pismo. Sorry, I always refer to this, but I experienced it there. You know, we had a group that lived up in Pismo Heights, and they covered several blocks up there, and they were interested in undergrounding utilities. Well, the city didn't have the money to pay for it, but they kept coming to city council meetings, and finally the city council said, "All right, staff, good contract for a report. Let's see what the cost is going to be." And so they identified what the cost would be, and they brought that forward, and it was about, at that time, 12 years ago or something, it was $15,000 a lot. And we rolled that out to everybody and said, hey, for $15,000 a lot, we can put it against your property taxes over time and be paid off over time, however you want to do it. You can give us the money right now, whatever. We're open. That group of folks that kept coming to the meetings, the council went to adopt that program because they were going to form an assessment district. They're like, we don't want any part of it. And they didn't show up. Only one guy showed up. And needless to say, the council wasn't happy about spending the money on the report, since then there was no support after that, I don't know. But at that time it was, $15,000, and that was 12 years ago.
I think I had my neighbor approach me when we were doing the remodeling. I think he said 18,000 was what he had heard.
Sounds about right, yeah.
Personally, I'd be against the in lieu fee right now. Our conversation at our last meeting, when we talked about the opportunities to increase affordable housing by having people convert garages and stuff, to me that's a lot more important than visual looks right now. Now, I think we could add it later on if we needed to, but I think we should be encouraging people to go back and convert garages and do the things they need to do to increase our affordable housing.
I don't think that this would apply to that, though, would it? If that would be a more remodel, that's not a brand new development.
Correct.
Right? So you wouldn't have to pay any of
okay.
that.
Okay, I thought you...
But
a garage conversion would... You're going from a garage, uniform building code, to a single-family dwelling. You're going to make them pay all the fees, all the improvement fees, aren't you?
The in-lieu fee isn't just applied to everybody. It would be applied to projects that had that condition placed on them. That's what committee member Groppi was referring to. So they were doing major remodels and additions. Do we want to include those in here, too? And it's a fair question. You might want to. I don't know. I actually didn't get back around to that. I'm sorry I didn't kind of circle back around to that portion of it, Joe. But Yeah, it would just be in place when this scenario came forward. Right now, it's related to new development. So if it was for a house, and again, and maybe the pole's across the street or something, so they can't underground, they could pay the lieu fee and be done with it. And we're not sort of putting these conditions on projects that can't be carried out, which is also not a great thing to do from my standpoint, mm-hmm. and probably from a planning commission standpoint as well. You know, putting ineffective conditions on projects, why are we doing that? Mm-hmm. And so we should have a means by which they can carry out the condition, or we should just not require it anymore.
So it's my point, sorry. To clarify, was so my question to you, and I don't know if you, if you're going to have a garage and you're going to convert it to a single-family dwelling, or an accessory dwelling. Same thing, it's going to have impact fees when you pull that building permit, all right? You're not going to waive water, sewer, because a lessened amount.
We're not allowed to charge the full load.
But the city regulations have, I had to do a separate meter, so you have to do a separate meter and pay for all that. So when you're paying all those fees, to me, that's like a new construction project.
So the fees were different when you did yours. The law has since changed and limits the amount that we can charge. We were charging full boat for new water meters. You got a water meter, you charged, you know, for your accessory dwelling unit back when you did it,
right.
You paid the full boat for it.
Okay.
Now it's not the case. We can only, so the legislature passed laws, and now it says we can only charge a fee proportionate to the impact of the unit that's being built.
All right, so it defines it as more like a remodel than a new construction then.
Correct. We still do charge the fee. It's just it's a lesser amount because they've changed the legislation because they found just what you said.
The reason that you're talking about.
Perfect. Yeah, exactly. That's why they did it. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely correct. You were hit the nail on the head with that. That's why they did it.
Because of promoting affordable housing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Legislature found it to be a barrier.
Yeah, so it would be.
Getting back to the undergrounding, it seems like there's a difference between I'm building a new house and I'm building a new 16 new houses in one place. Mm-hmm. So the 16 houses in one place makes sense to me that the policy would say thou shalt underground or pay, but maybe not for the single house.
Right.
So that. Can we make a distinction between something that's substantial? And I know that's hard to define.
If the majority of you nod your head at me, yes, you can make the distinction.
Yeah.
But you need to do that affirmatively. I'm not going to change it without that.
So I also actually read the glossary because I had so much extra time. And I just wonder if there's a thing where we change the term shall to should. So shall is very prescriptive, and should is if it's possible, and that gives you a little more leeway in the language. Because I agree with the idea that if it's a 16-unit development, say Black Hills Villas, it makes sense to underground. It's all going in new and fresh, whereas a single home that's going up in the middle of a block where, as you say, the lines are going to have to come down poles and go in and under and not really be safe. Maybe doesn't make as much sense in that situation.
We could make it a little more nuanced if you want. I mean, mm-hmm. the requirement could be for undergrounding from the pole to the house, mm-hmm. you know, and then for houses, so we'll just differentiate between regular development houses. And so then if that is infeasible because the poles across the street are whatever, you know, the catty corner and it's way up, you know, so far away or something, then that they could pay the fee for that then.
Mm-hmm. I could see some kind of sliding scale, like for a small dwelling, for example, and that extra $15,000 would be a tremendous, you know, could be a very large percentage. If you're building a $1 million house, you know, an extra $15,000, I'm not saying you wouldn't feel it, but you'd feel it a lot less than if you're building, you know, something a lot smaller. So I don't know if there's room for that kind of flexibility. I mean, obviously, it doesn't really make logical sense because it probably costs just as much to underground for either one, okay?
Likely it does.
But in terms of the impact, you know, mitigating the impact on affordable housing and that sort of thing, I wonder if there's some mitigation that could happen that way.
New development's going to definitely be cheaper. You get multiple units, you're going to have you're underground, and when you go in and do all the utilities, they're going to be able to do them all at once instead of doing one house for one house. So you're going to get economy of scale on cost. It's got to be cheaper.
Mm-hmm. So maybe, you know, the implementing portion of this just says if undergrounding isn't possible, any lieu fee shall be paid toward undergrounding.
Yeah.
Maybe the portion of this should be the implementation piece that we put in the, you know, the back, right? Maybe
right.
that's mm-hmm. the maybe what that ends up being is we develop a plan that allows mm-hmm. for this.
Well, so or it should be considered.
Well, or you could say may be paid instead of shall be paid. So you set that up, and then down the road you look at your fee schedule and decide, are we adding this in or not? And that's a specific arrangement that's made outside of the general plan.
So what's been discussed here is a little bit of nuance, and mm-hmm. I think as opposed to just saying we're going to start doing the ALU fee thing and maybe not do a great job at it, let's do the implementation piece that says go develop an undergrounding plan
yeah.
that would include ALU
yeah.
fees, and then it's covered. And then we don't do it, we don't are charging it until
yeah.
we have the plan in place, meaning here's our undergrounding plan, city council, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I like that.
That would get a nod.
And I like that idea too, and if for no other reason, in a situation where there's an existing two-story house and a neighbor decides to remodel his house and build a second story, and if you don't do that underground from the pole to the connection, then it can actually impact the view of the neighbor whose second story view is now has an additional wire going through it. So there's
yeah.
reasons to think about why that should be required. Yeah.
Okay, so are you all comfortable if we develop mm-hmm. the plan mm-hmm. for it as opposed to just
yeah,
put the
yeah.
fee in place?
And,
because
yeah.
it seems like you're right, it leaves a little bit open, and if we put the plan together, it'll tell us exactly what we're supposed to do in any given scenario.
And right, and I think that I did have a problem. I guess that's where I started the discussion, but where it says the long-term goal is to replace all overhead utilities underground. It just seemed like a bit of a strong blanket statement.
It's based on input that we've gotten from the public. You know,
okay.
there's a desire in many of our neighborhoods. I mean, I mentioned the spaghetti a lot.
Yeah, until you have to pay for it, of course, or until, you know, and does it make sense to pay when it's not really bothering anybody?
So
anyway, that's just a thought.
Certainly,
and
as you say, yeah, the plan
yeah.
would probably be prioritize areas. So in the city's general plan for Pismo Beach, as an example, there was a priority list of undergrounding that we were supposed to use those funds for PG&E on. Those were all major. Those were all major arterials and collectors. It didn't get into the neighborhood thing, and so that's why we ended up developing this other sort of program. So,
Scott, just one last thing on that. Developing your, I like your approach, but that would not restrict anyone that voluntarily a group like what the example Glenn was throwing out. A short street by people or whatever people that they decide to want to do it themselves, there would still be provisions where they would be work with the city to do that.
Yeah, no,
they
we would work with anybody, any
yeah.
group that wanted to make
okay.
that happen. Yeah,
okay.
absolutely. Okay.
Is that it?
All right.
Okay. I had a sort of open for discussion the whole scenic vistas and viewpoints and view sheds idea and how that might relate. 437, 438 in there to our concept of going second and third stories in the downtown area. Does that interfere? Does that help inform how and where that could be done? You know, in some ways, if we adopt this and say we value view sheds, we value wherever we can stand and look and see the ocean, whatever we consider a good view, or see the mountains, in some ways that might help with some of the fears, I think, of the public, that suddenly we'd have three-story buildings all over the downtown core, because in many places it would interfere with views. So that would kind of be at least a subject for discussion, if not an automatic, well, you can't do it here because you're blocking that view corridor. Does that?
So I mean, we have, you know, as you're aware, that's moved through this body and
mm-hmm.
and was reviewed by Planning Commission recently.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the corridor that runs down Morrobay Boulevard. And then it goes down Main. And the Planning Commission, again, having concern about this, and committee member Graffi can back this up, we reduced the area for it. We stopped. So Morrobay Boulevard starting at Piney going west to Main Street, down Main Street, stopping at Beach.
Mm-hmm.
So just that very small area of the downtown is where we and we stopped it from extending over onto a harbor and that type of thing as well. So we constrained the area, which is where the direction from the Planning Commission has come so far. So it's very limited. There's probably 40-ish parcels in that, and probably less than 10 that could actually achieve going to that height based on the way things have been developed within the time frame of, you know, hopefully that's a 20-year document and we update it. We don't go 30-plus. So it is a more measured approach, and you can also see if you like it, you know, does it work or not. And so probably going to have less of an impact from a view standpoint. And then you see on the maps where the view corridors are allocated. It's not really in that area other than views out to the hillside, which potentially can have issues there, depending on how you apply the policy.
I know at that meeting I asked and thought about it afterwards. Can you establish something, for lack of a better term, I'll call that the zoning overlay in which the zoning criteria is what we talked about, as opposed, and to avoid that, I think what you called spot zoning, can you do something like that? Or am
I think maybe I'm missing it. So what's the question?
You know, my question at the time was, if there were so few lots that were even a remote possibility of being developed to third stories, perhaps the new zoning for a higher height would be relegated to just those 20 or 30 properties, but somehow avoid the illegality of spot zoning by sort of saying, well, this is in a district in which if you have adequate parking and you have adequate light and you're sufficiently far away from a residential, you know, set up essentially the same criteria that you used to come up with those possibilities becomes the criteria for some sort of a...
I think because it now doesn't correspond to zoning, it'll be an overlay now. That's how that'll be pushed out.
Okay.
Otherwise, you have to change the zoning of that area, and that doesn't make sense because those lots that are outside of that area are very similar to the lots that are inside of it. And we're only dealing with the height issue. The rest of that area feels very much the same. So changing the zoning there wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. So now the conversation that we had with Martha, who's the consultant working on that portion of the update, we talked about doing a type of overlay. So I think that's where we're moving on that.
While we're in the view shed, there's a nice little map here on figure C7. I never can find the page numbers.
440.
We've got the Highway 141 corridor, and one thing that the Open Space Alliance has talked about a few times is seeking scenic highway designation for Highway 41. We started talking with Atascadero on the other end. Is that something that could be added to the implementation section, or how would that fit in? Does it make sense to add it into this plan?
Would you like us to add it to the plan?
Well, for those of you who are not part of the Open Space Alliance, we're looking for ways to add protection to the viewshed, which scenic designation would do, prevent development that would degrade those areas. It's a very pretty road. I mean, intuitively it fits. There's some political work that has to be done on both ends and with the county to make it happen, but it seems feasible to us. And a reasonable thing to add if, you know.
I mean, big chunks of Highway 1 are designated scenic highways, including portions that run through the city. So, if you're interested, speak up. So if we get, you know, majority of you doing that, we can make changes.
Well, I'm talking to my colleagues here.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm saying. I mean, one of you speaking is great.
Any other thoughts on that idea?
Yeah. We just need more of you, you know, saying yay or nay, that's a great idea, or, you know, because it's not a big change to the document to have us look into what it would take to do that. That's fairly simple. Mm-hmm. And to support that. And so we can carry that forward. That would be a change to it, but that's fine. That's why you're here.
I would support that, particularly I'm recalling all that discussion when the Sonic drive-in was going to come in there, and about that being one of the gateways to Morro Bay and 41 and all that business. So I think that would be a good idea.
That's a great example, because the Planning Commission had lots to say about what that looked like for our gateway. So, absolutely.
Right. I would support that also, and it may possibly open us up for funding or grants that might be possible with that.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask a little silly question, I guess, on the map on figure C7, the legend, what are those red arrows for? The legend only shows the slashes for the city limit. There doesn't say what the left.
So those are the
Views.
The seating views.
So those are views.
If you're standing at the non-arrow part of the line, you would have the view towards the arrow. And these are actually, we started with your existing map in your existing general plan, LCP, okay. And I believe we added a few.
Okay, thanks.
Can I ask a question about the sewer, the new water treatment plant? Is doing anything along Highway 41 potentially going to, for lack of a better term, get in the way of any of that?
No,
I wouldn't think so, but I just want to ask the question.
Okay. No, I mean, if there was, you know, off Highway 41, you know, that's more
of... more on the other part of town.
That's one of the areas where, you know, we'd be looking to potentially do the... putting the, you know, the water, do the injection wells. But
right.
Those, you know, would be in an area that are rural, and we'd have... it would look like a rural structure. It wouldn't look like a, you know... So, yeah.
Okay.
As opposed to it looking like an industrial-type structure or something.
And didn't I read in here that Highway 1, a lot of Highway 1 between San Luis and Morro Bay is already protected, right, with the morros along
yes.
there?
It, mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
So 41 needs to be included.
That's a good idea.
So you get the nod, I think.
Yeah, I think so. No, I agree. I think I got a majority of you saying that. I'm comfortable.
Just... one quick clarification on page 442, policy C88, lighting levels, preserve skyward nighttime views and lessen glare to minimize lighting levels in open spaces and along the coastline. I'm assuming that means lighting in our parks or, say, out at Morro Rock versus lighting along the waterfront or even in downtown areas. I know there have been night sky issue discussions before. But then if you look at, jumping all the way ahead to 4118, policy CW11 with crime prevention through environmental design, which has to do with good lighting so that you're kind of minimizing some of your crime activities, but also encouraging people to feel comfortable walking the streets at night, which is something we've talked about wanting to develop more of. So... just wanted to check and see, you know, are we kind of talking two different areas here?
Okay. Yeah, and we do have references to dark sky policies in our mm-hmm. zoning code related to new development. There's, you know, certainly been a tilt on the Planning Commission towards concern about any lighting that's on the backside of buildings that front the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the areas where we don't want to have those lights because, you know, we do have animals swimming around the water out there too, and so it's one of the things that we've given that concern. It's one of the things we're pushing into the ordinances so that we don't have those things.
Well, that's a challenging one, though, given that your harbor walk is on the backside of all those buildings, so, and you want lighting there.
So you do low-level lighting that allows you to see and walk safely without okay. having, you know, a lighted sign that's mm-hmm. sitting out there, you know,
right.
those types of
right.
things.
Neon.
And
yeah.
then shielded above lighting that would go down that would just be
okay.
low-level, you know,
yep.
that it allows you to see and fine and be safe, but not,
mm-hmm.
You know, stand out over the water and those types of things. Reduce
okay.
light spill, that type of thing.
And I was just looking, I believe we have an implementation action. It's either in land use or community design. I'm looking for it now about the lighting along the Harbor Walk.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Oh,
okay.
That's right. Yeah. There's something in there.
So does anybody have anything between there and page 448 about cultural and historic resources? I don't want to jump ahead if we've got things in between.
What do you mean by in between from the
well,
beginning?
Well, no, from where we were.
Back in C13? Like, we skipped a lot of stuff.
I know. We've gone back and forth. So do whatever you...
Well, I just was going in order.
I know. It's easier
and
that way.
I have some... I just don't really know quite how all this ESHA stuff fits together because we have some designated ESHA areas. And it seems to me like the development in a lot of cases is already out of the barn door. Is there any way to... this is maybe my education and general plan stuff again, but if we're setting setbacks of 25 to 50 feet and we only permit development in there under certain conditions and there's got to be mitigation, blah, 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 something's already built on some of those areas. Is it the case that those are basically grandfathered inside the buffers if they're already built and that
That's, for the most part, correct.
Okay. So these would apply to only if you want to redevelop it, or if it's undeveloped at this point, then this is what holds.
Correct.
Okay. Too bad.
Trying to make my job a lot harder.
So can I jump in now? I would like to talk about the air quality.
I get to get
step up for public comment on air quality, because that's down there too.
So we are in that grouping, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Because this is what I came up about 6 months ago when I was talking about the air quality and that you're using the counties.
Can you give us your name, sir?
My name is Brom Webb.
Brom, was that?
It's B-R-O-M, and the last name's Webb.
Oh, okay, sorry.
That's quite all right.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what I did was I've done some studying on this, and I've noticed that basically what we have is the EPA is very laxed. So with the population of under 500,000 people, that they really don't care. So you get to San Luis Obispo's air quality area, and they have 10 little areas that they put little places of monitoring effects. And so what we have is we have the ozone in Morro Bay. So that's the only one we have. And what I've been doing is I've been looking online, and what they have is they have websites now. And the one website's really cool. It's called AQICN.org. And what it is, it's a worldwide website, which everybody's cities goes and they hook up, go into the cloud, and they basically can tell you what your air quality is in the city. So San Luis Obispo has this, Napomo has this, so you can go on their little website, pop up, and at any time see what their air quality is. And I was just hoping that Morro Bay would come around the corner, because the technology has come so far. And for, I think I got a quote for $1,500. It's just a little box. You could put it right there on the 2601 Coral Street address, hook it right in, and you, within 6 months, you'd have data for the general plan here in Morro Bay, and you could use actual data. So that's what I'm proposing. So while you're agreeing with all this stuff, I thought I might want to jump in.
So agreeable. What's 2601 Coral Street?
It's the actual in between where the cloisters and the high school is, and it's a little trail, and then there's actual place, I think, I don't know, is it water that's out there? There's actual a gated place where City of Morro Bay goes up and does their work, but it's actually a gated, what you would call a gated community.
So why did you choose it? I don't understand.
Why did I choose that?
Oh, yeah, that address.
So basically, one is that you could actually attach the device to the gate.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Yeah. Two, it's close enough to the ocean, and it's in between the ocean and the highway. So you're going to get this whole effect of the sand coming up when it's real windy.
Yeah.
When it's no wind at all, you're going to get the effect from the highway. So you'll get, like, a real good sense of data. Because when I was first seeing this, I was like, you all should have, like, five different monitors all over the city, but it's a little out of control. But this one monitor will basically do everything that you need to do. And it may be your one little piece of the pie that you're missing. Okay, because having an air monitoring program basically comes back around, and you can then walk into a federal grant, as he was just applying towards. So hopefully you can look into this a little bit more.
Yeah.
And maybe add that into our general plan.
And one last question. What is the source of the ozone?
The ozone, and now those are all that, I mean, that's basically the source of ozone is, I mean, you would have to go into the definition of what the ozone gases are.
Seems
but
like
what I'm saying is that this they have the devices now that will pick up everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, the one that I got quoted was for $1,500, and it was missing the PM10, which is the biggest one, which is a particular matter. The biggest particular matter.
I think that is a great idea as part of our implementation. If we're serious about looking at good air quality and saying this is a community that cares about health issues and so on.
We have several air monitoring stations that are around the area, and some of them monitor different things. I think at our baseline assessment there's a list of traffic.
Everything that I found.
So it was missing ozone because that's no longer locally monitored. And I remember when you talked to us about this before.
Right.
I I do believe that I just read an article in the last couple months for the most recent countywide data, and I think what that said was that the biggest ozone issue is in the far eastern part of the county. I don't know if you saw that as well.
No.
And it has to do with air coming from the Central Valley.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And so you figure in 20 years' time, you're going to have San Francisco, L.A., and then the Valley all sort of coming back where the ocean's going to be pushing back. And we have no data. Mm-hmm. So anybody who's monitoring the air, I guess, from far away is okay. But once you get to ground level, it's like it's useless.
Mm-hmm. Can I repeat back the website to you to make sure I got it?
Yes.
It's AQICN?
Yes, standing for Air Quality Index. And I'm figuring the CN's control network or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. All right. So we're good.
Thank you.
Scott, I have a question. I meant to text you back when I'd ask you about the historical regulations we have in the city. And then your reply was this California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, requires us to evaluate anything over 50 years old to determine historical significance. My question is, will this be in the general plan or in the zoning? Are we going to have that? Will that language be anywhere, or is that just something you know?
Part of the requirements for evaluating. I think
the language wasn't in here, though, and I noticed that, too, that 50-year thing, which is kind of significant for the layperson reading this and saying, well, I just want to tear this building down, to know that it's 50 years old, and before you do that, you have to
I guess I would ask, look to Glenn and see what your group do you think that should be in GPAC? I mean, in the general planning reference to the regulation that requires to determine historical significance?
I think in the implementation section it outlines a four-step process for putting together a historical preservation program. And this was in the key issues and priorities is where it first came up.
Mm-hmm.
So we're aware of it, and we started trying to look for the people to get going on planning it. A little hard, but, the first steps are to put together a group of people who are representative of different areas of historical preservation program and to begin to develop an ordinance. There are a lot of models out there we can use, some good ones. We're not starting from ground zero, but we do need to have some people willing to work on it, and that's the first problem we're having. So we got to get going on that. I feel a lot of urgency about it because I think there are some buildings that are vulnerable to being taken and reused that would actually be worth preserving. It's tricky because people who own those buildings may have different ideas than I do. So there's a political process we have to go through to reach something where the community can live with it.
But there's also state laws that just flat out say if it's 50 years or older, and actually I did notice we have 45 years, so they do have a little bit of leeway because some things, and the building, for example, has to be considered unique, the only one of few of its kind, have certain historic events or people associated with it. I mean, there's a list of things that's the state law.
Yeah.
One thing I took issue with here is that Morro Bay likely has many historic and cultural resources. It does.
Mm-hmm.
Morro Bay has historic and cultural resources. It has stuff that's on the sacred lands file. It has things that are identified with the Native American Heritage Commission as being prehistoric sites that require certain amount of oversight, monitoring, and experts to be called in before they're developed. So I think, and we may not be able to have a public overlay map of those places, for example, because that's not allowed to be put out in the general public knowledge, but planning staff would have that.
Well, I think one of the reasons I brought it up was the fact that we're talking about, well, it's already moved on to planning commission, but rate the height increase downtown, and those are, that goes in hand with the old historical buildings that we're talking about.
Yes.
So people may be encouraged to do renovations to get that third story that will affect the historical status.
And one of the reasons that I do feel some urgency about it is I didn't hear the planning commission. I'm sorry, I didn't. But that there was some discussion about single story buildings being more likely to be chosen for redevelopment.
Right.
those single-story buildings are likely to be some of the most historical ones.
They're going to be a lot of times the older ones. We have a lot of like historic bungalow type.
Yeah, homes. And at least some of them, you know, and Coalesce always comes to mind when people think about this. We don't ever want to lose that. So, I am concerned about it. By the way, regarding Susan's remark, state law does have some things to say about this, but we need to have a process in place here before we can link into it. So,
I would say for 45 years probably is a significant amount of the housing stock here.
It is. It comes up regularly, you know, and oftentimes, I mean, when we go to the evaluation, it's not found to be historic.
Right.
So that's the issue that Silloway is probably referring to, is we can designate our own ones that we find to be significant and place policies as it relates to their redevelopment, additions, and things like that. Without that, we don't have any hook there. So if it's not found to be historically significant, consistent with the parameters that Susan laid out, then they're good to go. And that might be one of the houses that the city finds to be important, but we don't have any hook to say that you can't do it. And so that's why the policy says, you know, go develop a historic resource strategy and document to say and to identify, do the surveys, find out where they're at, and that type of thing.
Create an inventory.
So I think that's likely a kind of public-private partnership that we do, both internally from city staff and then working with an outside group to sort of leverage the work that you've done to this point. So
the historical system. Because as we stand now, CEQA is the default. Okay.
It is.
That's
and so
all we have.
Yeah, and if it's not, you know, associated with a historic place or person or is a particularly interesting type of architecture or designed by somebody that's, you know, well-known or something like that, then there's no hook to the city that it has any impact by CEQA. It just says it can be torn down.
Yeah, and I think if you look at cities around the country that really have a really well-developed historical preservation policies and districts, you know, I think without exception, these always started as sort of homegrown historical preservation efforts. And that's really...
You have to have a champion out there.
You can't rely on.
I mean, you have to have a champion if you want to have any significant policies in there. You know, if it's city grown, you're going to have a watered down type situation that's really has most of the CEQA policies in there, and not a lot more. Because if there's not a group out there championing these are important to the city of Morro Bay, then who's going to do that? It probably isn't something that comes out of your staff.
It would be
the historic preservation group that's like, these are important to the city. We need to preserve these or what have you. And then it starts there. So it is grassroots, I agree. If you're going to have any real policy like you're talking about.
Yeah, and likewise, I don't think the champion is going to come out of the state.
From the state
or certainly not the federal.
Yeah.
Is there any, I'm just trying to read tea leaves, but would there be any possibility that council could be persuaded to put the height approval, if they're going to go with the 37?
Correct.
Foot, could they put that in abeyance until our historical thing is organized so that you can look at these things before developers come in and, you know, because think about it. I mean, we sat in our group meetings with the public, and we all talked about the eclectic nature of the downtown and the buildings. We're talking about bringing more people up to the downtown, and adding three stories for maybe affordable housing, which I support. But then, if we're going to tear down historical buildings that are the heart of the ambiance of the downtown, what do we gain?
Go ahead.
Just to throw something else into the mix, it is possible to maintain historical buildings and add stories to them.
Yes.
It costs money, but just to make sure that we're also thinking about that.
Yeah. I know one store owner actually on Main Street who, when we talked about the idea, would love to go to a second story for a dwelling unit above her store, and it is a historic building, and she would totally just keep the facade as it is. And she said it's a cinder block building, actually, behind all that frontage. But I wonder if we looked at the old pictures, how many of them were two-story buildings originally that eventually were torn down? And I mean, I think the old Schneider household that was in that one corner was a big two-story building. I mean, it's long gone.
Yeah.
But and also thinking of places Well, like Rio Salon already has apartments above it, and then the locksmith shop next to it is just a funky old building that, yeah. You know, that would, it would be cool to redevelop that with a historic look, make it two stories or even three, have the housing above, but really do something neat with that property because it's kind of unattractive.
You're right. You can still maintain the historical status, but I've put my contractor builder hat on that I got rid of a long time ago. A developer is going to come in, and the cost, and for example, if anybody went through the siren as they were building the siren and saw the amount of steel I-beam reinforcement was required to satisfy the seismic requirements, he could have tore that building down and started over, but he didn't want to. So most developers are going to, I think, take the path of least resistance and want to tear that down. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't get protections in place and they just have CEQA, then they're going to tear down some of these old buildings.
I see both sides, though, because I do think if you allow a developer to have that opportunity to fit second and possibly third stories in the same footprint, they get more bang for the buck. So, you know, maybe it's still feasible to keep that bottom floor in, you know, but build in the infrastructure inside to create, I don't know. But I totally understand the developer's dilemma when it comes to that.
It's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts or...
Well, I'm you know, remembering Commissioner Lucas's thoughts on the look of the downtown area, and you know, he's the proponent of paying a lot of attention to scale, and I guess we have to also be careful about some of these larger spaces of the world somehow aggregating one or two of these lots that might be available for higher height extensions, and creating structures that are just larger than we'd like. It's the smallness of the commercial fronts that really create that coziness and small America feel. That's my only thought, really.
We have design policies that speak to that currently. I mean, and the desire, by the commission, you're well aware, is to develop commercial design guidelines, a specific set of commercial guidelines instead of the more generalized ones that we have. But we do have those, and we have pushing them out through this process as well. So,
like, could Bank of America be built now? I mean, talk about a big, ugly block building. That
I don't think it would fit with the character of the city. I mean, you would have to be a different architectural style for sure, and you know, have to be more respective of what's around it. It certainly stands out like a sore thumb. Really.
Yeah.
Well, we have 2 hours left, so just to give you a time check.
Okay. Any.
Yep.
Yeah, we said we're going till 7.
I've got a real easy one for you. It's a little thing, but number C22 implementation is linked to policy C6.3. No.
The page are you on?
435.
435 is policy C6.4. And I think in your implementation you say advocate for. Isn't that a politically charged issue?
For example, City of San Luis Obispo decision makers advocated for it. So it's, in this case, community choice aggregation, and I'm not saying that we have to leave it the way it is, but it's advocating, I believe, to the, you know, other agencies and even the state to be able to have that local decision making. So I think that's the reason it was written that way.
And we're doing it right now. The Catholic Council authorized the city manager to move forward, so we're in process.
I think it's exciting.
I support it. I just wondered if you wanted that political language in your document. So.
Given that we're doing it, it's not really a big deal, I don't think. All right. Or it hasn't proven to be since they said to go do it.
There's a few places in here where we refer to Cerrito. Is that open space? Never mind. I'm jumping ahead.
For what?
Cerrito Peak, but I think that's in the open space, so I'll wait. Yeah. There's a couple of references in here to the desalinization plant, and I was under the impression that it is not actually functioning and furthermore is not easily fixed. So you have references to it being used for brackish water. I think there's only like a portion of it that's used to treat brackish water, but as a desal facility, it's worn out. It's 30 years old and the parts wear out. So I wonder if that's something to keep in here.
It was designed to do that. We still maintain seawater wells. We've run them recently to see how they're functioning, and the plant needs some upgrading. If we were to treat seawater, but we run the brackish drains. When the state water project shuts down, we run it anywhere from a week to 2 weeks to maintain our water supply during that shutdown. The plant is, you know, it was built a while ago, so it's not automated. We have to run it when it's running. There has to be a person on site to do it. So I mean, the plant needs upgrading if we're going to do more with it. That'll come out of the one water plan that we're working on. The Public Works Department's working on dealing with all of our water issues, looking at all of our water infrastructure, wastewater infrastructure, all those types of things. So that'll become more defined, you know, as we move forward, you know, with that plan. It's just running parallel to this, so it's hard to have one informing the other when they're doing this and we don't have finalized documents. So we sort of have to be, I think, a little more generalized, like we have a desal plant, and with some repairs to it, it could operate. But again, that one water plan will inform where we go moving forward. So I don't think it's an issue leaving it in here the way that it is, just because we need to do repairs to the existing facility. It's probably acceptable until we determine what we're going to do after we get through the one water process.
Move on to open space. Okay. So the open space element is another one of your required elements, and we have an overview as well as the resiliency approach sections at the beginning. We have a section called open space resources. It starts with your open space diagram and then talks about types of open space. The key issues generally are called open space resources, and they're split into the two main types. So one in this element is called community-based parks, trails, and recreation. That's what is sometimes shorthanded as parks. And then natural open space, which is the open space that we think of like on Black Hill, that type of thing. And that is the overview for the open space element. So I'll leave it to you guys.
I'll go back to my Cerrito Peak comment, and it's simply that you refer to Cerrito Peak a number of times in the document, and I ask you to put / Eagle Rock in there. And the reason is that that's the way many people in the community think of it, and it is a sacred place registered in the historic preservation by the Salinan tribe, and they refer to it as Eagle Rock in that document. So just simple.
Yeah, unless there's an objection from the rest of you, I think that's a good add. And people refer to it commonly around town as that, so yeah. Fair point. Thank you.
So the privately owned versus publicly owned parks would be Lila Kaiser, 459, the Morro Bay Golf Course, and part of the bike park. Would that be correct? And
the parking lot for the bike park is privately
private. Okay.
It's owned by PG&E.
Okay.
Boys and girls.
It was just interesting looking at those ratios and calculations of what's park and what's private, what's public, all of that. And I always think of Morro Bay as having a lot of park space, but it didn't look like as much as...
We actually have a pretty high ratio compared to other communities.
Okay.
I mean, it might not seem like a lot, but from a per capita type standpoint, we do.
Mm-hmm.
There's also so much open space that...
Yeah.
I think the same thing about San Luis Obispo.
Yeah.
There's so many places to recreate.
Mm-hmm. Scott, just out of curiosity,
Loud Kaiser Park is owned by Dynegy?
It is. We lease it for a dollar a year.
And so Dynegy is currently being in the process of being sold?
It's being acquired or has been acquired, whether it's closed or not, I don't know, by Vistra Energy.
It did close.
How will it affect this Lila Kaiser Park? Is that part of the...
We have an agreement right now. I mean, it could affect it moving. I mean, so I would look at it this way. You're going to do anything with the property that's there. You're going to come into the city for permits, and you're going to take away the park?
Not so
good
popular.
Luck. I can't imagine what the response from the community would be.
Thank you.
But I don't imagine it would go well.
Okay. Thank you.
On page 457, you have a little table that lays out types of open spaces. I think if you read through this, those become clear what those designations mean, but the table concludes with that ratio, and until you go to the next page, it's kind of it's not clear what that ratio refers to, because you can't get to 31 acres adding any of those numbers up, so it's really based on something else. So I think that table needs to be reworked somehow to make it a little clearer where those numbers come from.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, while I'm at it, I'm going to add another thing in. The City Council passed a resolution designating a piece of public land above Tideland Park on the bluff as Franklin Riley Park. And it's not included in any of these charts or descriptions. It's an undeveloped area right now, totally. So you might look at it as, well, this is sort of like a Bayshore Bluffs. But we do have some plans, or we're working on some plans, to try to make some minor improvements in it to create a more inviting space. So I don't know.
Who is it owned by?
It's a city property now.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was just named this year, right? This past year?
Yes, it was recently.
Yeah, that might have been after we did our background report.
It was.
Yeah.
It was afterwards.
Okay, so I don't even know how, I think it's about an acre. I mean, I don't know. It's
we'll make that
a big difference in our percentages.
Right.
But it's good. It's all good.
Might get us up to 3. Who knows? What would that be? What kind of park would that be? Is that a community-based park? Is that what you'd call that, or is that a coastal park?
I guess it's Franklin. I guess it's community, because it's up on the bluff.
It's on the bluff, yeah.
It's on top of the bluff, so I guess it's community.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's city-owned, probably. Yeah.
Oh.
Community-based.
I should see this one. Gotcha. When parklets were last mentioned, it was said that they were going to be, the code or the plan was being re-looked at and reorganized and reported. But that's been a long time. Are there plans to put more parklets out? Or?
We haven't had any community interest.
Oh.
We've had none. So, you know, that was the big to-do, right?
You know,
and then there was some conversations a little bit after it happened, and there were folks that were interested in it, but then no one's ever, like, championed that cause.
Oh.
So, I mean, I guess the thing is, you know, resource-based. You spend time developing policies for things people don't really care about, probably not. And so that's nothing that we've heard, you know, in the intervening, you know, couple of years now, a year and a half, almost 2 years now, I guess.
So, so when I hear people murmur about that or come in and tell me about that, I should direct them to the city hall?
Yeah, I mean, if people aren't telling us or telling the council or telling the planning commission or telling anybody else, then we don't know. I mean, like I said, we spend time. I thought for a while, because there was interest, like, oh, we need to develop a policy for it. We can go do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been no interest put forward to put that on the city's radar. So, you know, it's like part of our goals and objectives process that we, you know, do every year. You know, maybe it could get into that and we could move forward with the policy. But right now, there hasn't been a desire to make it happen.
Is there much happening on the plan to change the parking on Main Street and Morro Bay Boulevard to like diagonal parking?
So the report that I'll be preparing and bringing back to council will happen after the first of the year. So it's in our goals and objectives to bring that forward, but I'm not going to bring it forward until after the election.
Well, that one, yeah, I can see that. That one place where it was implemented on, I'm trying to remember which street
Market.
It is. On Market Street. That seems really awful.
It's 90 degrees.
Well, it's not only 90 degrees, but when you come down the hill toward it, it sticks way out there. So if you try to make a right turn onto that street, you have to go into the other lane. It seems really unsafe. And if people are coming down the street toward it the other way, it's like right in their face. I mean, if they're not paying attention, they're going to just barrel on right there. It just seems like a just really bad design, right on that corner especially.
We haven't had any issues with it. And, you know, it's served to actually allow us to open a business there. That we wouldn't have otherwise been able to move into Morro Bay.
Well, I think if it was just moved away a little bit, that whole bulge out on the corner there just seems really bad.
The way you would want to do that is not through bollards, but since you didn't have any money, and we needed to put a protected area out there so people weren't running into the cars, and so that's what the Public Works Department came up with. Ideally, you would have a planner that, in the end, that's how you design these things. Normally, it would just there was no funds to make that happen.
It's not that it's not reinforced enough. It's that it's in the way, and really awkward. And like I said, you make a right turn, you have to go in the other lane. You can't get out of that. And
yeah, the turning movement there is not fantastic.
And then people coming down the other way when you're trying to make that turn, really seems very hazardous.
It needs to be. I would agree that some reconfiguration needs to be done.
Yeah.
And I think Public Works is actually aware of that issue. I don't know what the plan is on their side of things, but it's been something that's been brought forward.
I'm excited about diagonal parking on the boulevard.
Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, I hope that you can get that accomplished.
I would imagine the council is going to tell us to go look at it. I mean, again, you know, just for the couple of streets that I looked at, it's 200 to 20, 25 to 250 mm-hmm. parking spaces.
Mm-hmm.
It's and paint on the ground, so it's not expensive.
Love paint.
Yeah.
So, in the implementation, number OS2 is on page 526. This is talking about partnering with groups to apply for grants to help enhance and expand park and recreation opportunities. And this is simply a question that's pretty self-interested, obviously, but in Franklin Riley Park, we have a nice grant now from the Jonah John Solu Family Foundation, named for his dad, to get started making improvements on that park. Does this item mean that we can actually go to you, and say, we want to do some this, we have a plan for this, and we need $30,000, we only have 10. Can you help us get it? Is that what this means?
It could mean that. The idea is that we partner with groups that are out there to go make things happen because city's resources are limited, individual groups' resources are limited. We get together, maybe we can make more things happen than you could otherwise do. And so that the idea is like that. Maybe the city can apply for grant funding that you can't go get. We can go after it if we can come up with a plan. Maybe you can come up with a plan because there's folks in your group that can develop a plan that might lay something out there. So it's that type of thing. It's not unlike, the city supporting some of the gardening groups that are in town about putting some money in our budget, in the next budget. FY 18-19 budget has some money in there that Public Works can pay for the plants that some of the gardening groups would go out there and plant in various areas. And so it's that type of thing exactly.
Okay, all right. And you just preempted my next question about those items further down there, OS9 and OS8, which you're talking about adopt-a-park kinds of programs.
Yeah, and the council, two meetings ago, adopted the adopt-a-thing program.
Yeah.
So we have it in place now, okay. which is great.
Yeah. As long as we're on that page, OS4, implement an incentive program for local waterfront businesses and leaseholders to encourage regular maintenance and upgrades of infrastructure at nearby trails and parks. Mm-hmm. I wondered if the responsibility for that should be the Harbor Department rather than community development. I mean, I know you guys talk to each other, but that sort of relates to Harbor, and all of those leaseholders would be paying into the Harbor Fund. And
so,
or maybe both? We have quite a few.
Yeah,
probably both.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
just take a little off your shoulders, you know. Throw some on Harbor.
I talk to the Harbor director almost every day. I mean,
yeah,
we do a lot of things crossover. Probably have half a dozen emails from them today on various things we're doing. So yeah, that's good.
On the back to the parklet, I'm trying to remember the development that's going on. Supposed to start this fall down past the Little Hut, Harbor Hut, past the Harbor Hut, and then they're going to tear down the Dockside 3 and put up. Is it a pocket park or a parklet?
It's a pocket. Pocket park. It's very small. Yeah, it's a very. So I guess you can call it that. It's basically, you know, a landscaped area where you could sit. It's not much bigger than.
What's
that.
The logic on tearing down that eclectic building?
I don't try to. So it's there's a leaseholder in that building. They're going to take the Dockside 3 building and the little kayak rental thing that's there and charter whatever.
Right,
tear that down. And then they're going to build one building there that's two stories and put those uses into that building. And there'll be one new building there.
Was that little park a requirement of his development?
It was like mitigation of open space.
Our planner that works on it can maybe give you a better explanation. Cindy, take it away.
It was part of the findings for granting all of the redevelopment. So there's been some new dock slips that have been added over the years, in the last few years, especially to the left of Harbor Hut. So that's all part of a master revitalization of that area. This demolition is the land side equivalent of what you've been seeing cumulatively over the last few years. The pocket park, though, there'll be trash can there for public use. There'll be a couple of benches, but it'll definitely be small. And then also there'll be some improvements to the parking area because right now there's not a good turning radius for delivery trucks. So it's supposed to make circulation a lot better. It's that circulation, though, that's limiting the size of the pocket park.
It seems like a sidewalk would be a better...
They are extending the sidewalk.
They are going to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It is going to get pushed down a little bit.
Hazardous.
Where the name escapes me, the... sport fishing place that's near Dockside 3.
Morro Bay Landing?
Morro Bay Landing, yeah.
Right.
That's the applicant, how could I forget?
And when was that project originally approved?
It was originally approved in 2008, and they got multiple amendments. The reason the permit hasn't expired, and this is a good point to make because we get it asked a lot from the public, is because there were multiple lease sites. The planning permit was inaugurated with the first of those building permits, and it was always intended and it was approved to be phased over many years just because mm-hmm. of the scale of the project. It's just this demo reconstruct is going to be very visible to the public, and it probably will open some eyelids when they see that. But it'll be nice when it's done, and the City Council has recently saw it. I think they saw plans like a year ago or so. So it's not that it hasn't been to a recent public hearing.
Yeah, thank you. It's way too late, but it occurred to me looking at the plan that couldn't they have taken that if it's a requirement for what you just described, which was, I get that, it would have been nice maybe to move that down to the closer to Coleman to have a nicer development park down there that would be used more by people walking on the boardwalk. Then I just don't see people using that little space right there. Is it going to have a view there?
Right. There will be a small view corridor.
But not much.
Yeah. I completely appreciate what you're saying about Coleman Park. For this particular project, though, they had to provide public benefit within their lease site boundaries.
Okay.
And the second floor of the new Morro Bay Landing building is where the Dockside 3 restaurant will go, and there'll be outdoor seating in that area that will be open to the public, so you can pack a bag lunch and go up there. And then the docks themselves are part of the public access. Waterfront projects require, public lateral access. So it's got a lot of different unique things, and it'll be a nice addition.
It's a nice-looking building.
Will there be seating in that little pocket park area?
Like one or two benches.
It's pretty small. To me, that's worth it. I mean, walking with elderly people sometimes who just... every block or so need to sit for a minute. It's not a bad thing to add those in.
Yeah, so. And just north of that is where the harbor offices and the Coast Guard building mm-hmm. are. Mm-hmm. So if you're coming from Coleman Park, that's a good rest stop yeah. if you are, you know, mm-hmm. Have accessibility or ability issues.
I do think with the pocket parks, the whole idea of widening our sidewalks almost alleviates the need for some of that, because we already see people, at least in downtown area, using the sidewalks where they're wide enough for tables and chairs and dining, and all of that's going on, I assume, with permits.
Is that allowed? I can't tell you how many times I've almost tripped over dogs
yeah.
and leashes and table legs and things like that. Are people allowed to appropriate the sidewalks for their business?
In the downtown, there's the ability for you to get permits to put tables and things out there. Are there permits for the stuff that's out there?
That was sort of the question.
There is a little proliferation going on, I've noticed. Yeah.
That is in the new zoning code.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, there'll be a more formalized process that we'll be able to go through and take care of these things. It's a little bit sort of, unless there's a health, life, safety issue happening right now,
yeah.
we're sort of waiting until we get all of this in place so then we can go and say, hey, here's what you can do and what you can't do now, mm-hmm. because it's not well spelled out.
Right.
I can think of
a few places where it might be to their benefit to do a little bulb out.
Well, yeah, right now there's just a fair amount of obstruction of the sidewalks in some of those areas,
hard.
And it is hazardous.
Yeah. That area on Market Street in front of the old D'Estasio's place that has been turned into kind of a little seating area, is that part of that hotel there?
Next to doors?
No, yes, across from.
Yeah, yes, yeah, yes. The new owner that came in there and redeveloped it, She came in, went through the permitting process uh-huh. and changed that out, demo the pool that was out there
right.
and create that seating area. There's another component of it that they haven't come forward with. They just didn't, would include a covered pergola like thing that would go over the top.
I would really recommend that. It's a nice area. My son said, I don't know if I'd sit there. It looks like it belongs to the hotel. But it's pretty open. So maybe some signage that just says you're welcome to.
I think that would be
nice.
A great idea.
But it's I think an improvement.
Oh, it looks great. Yeah.
Well, if you remember what you said, the pool behind it and that row, that hedgerow of bushes around it, they just totally blocked off all views into the site. So they've at least come up and cleaned up the site. They've done a nice job. They remodeled the rooms that they came in there. So they've done a nice job upgrading that facility.
Yeah, maybe they'll do that in a lot across from them.
Chained off.
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
Anything would be nice.
So another thing that we talked about was. Somewhere in this plan, if we were reminded that the area from Beach Street, the Embarcadero from Beach out to the Rock, is primarily supposed to be for commercial fishing.
Measure D.
And that boats like Papagallo and Chablis could not be there because they're recreation more than commercial fishing. So when does that go into effect? When this plan is approved?
So we have language that's going into the language and policy that's going in to help better define what you can do there. A lot of it's going into the zoning code. It's not going to be those things, those boats like that, the argument has been boats like that have been in that area for a while, so they're existing non-conforming and can be maintained as a use there right now. Moving forward, we're going to be very specific about how we deal with those types of things. I mean, it's been kind of loose and not well defined. And while you get a lot of arguments, the Measure D is very clear. From an implementation standpoint, it's not, which is why a subcommittee of the Planning Commission and Harbor Advisory Board was formed to work through policy language. And then we met at a joint meeting with the Planning Commission and Harbor Advisory Board to adopt that policy unanimously, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And now that language and information is being pushed out through the zoning code portion of the update.
So it's currently being implemented in little steps, is that what you're saying?
Implemented, so those boats will be allowed to remain because they're for the historic use. But moving forward, you know, there won't be any question about whether you can or can't do those things. It'll be a little, the intent behind it has been defined a little bit better and a little more straightforward in the zoning code. So there won't be as much, ambiguity and question as to what you can and can't do there.
So then my next question is, are there other places where those boats can be, down toward Highland Park or something? Are there other dock areas?
All of the area south of Beach Street, all of the docks there. Mm-hmm.
I should say available dock areas.
There are available dock areas there.
And page 326 is where we added some of the higher level language that came out of that process. and that does have the three sectors that have been identified. And then, like Scott said, the zoning code will have the detailed regulations and interpretation.
That's right. That's right. We did. We put it in there.
I think it is important to have a place for those kind of things. I think they really, really give people an appreciation for the bay and are just a really nice tourist
attraction. They like to get out on it.
Attraction.
I mean,
yeah, they're wonderful.
It's
yeah.
fantastic. Yeah, I come here with friends and stuff regularly and go out on those things to show because they don't otherwise get to do things like that.
And a fair amount of the activity there is local people who rent it for birthdays or something like that. So at least that's from my experience.
Can I get off the water here for a second? Back to open space. On page 473, goal 7, we're addressing the issues that come from open space that is in what would be the sphere of influence outside of our city boundaries and planning issues that are there. The policies that are listed do not address passive recreation. And the reason I'm bringing it up is that part of the proposed sphere of influence would include the watercourse of Alva Paul from about a mile and a half inland down to Del Mar Park. And that corridor would be an incredible trail. And it would be such an asset to this city to be able to use that if it ever comes to pass. And we're still working on the easement there. But a terrific asset that would link Del Mar Park with these trails. And I wonder if a policy looking forward to being open to that kind of development would be useful in here, because I think it should be a priority. I know the people in the Open Space Alliance consider it a high priority for trail development in the Chevron properties, Toro Creek Hills.
Comments from the rest of you?
I agree.
Yeah, I would agree without reservation, yeah.
Does anybody feel that this is a terrible idea? Okay, I think we can work that in maybe.
Thank you.
One last comment about it. Right now, Del Mar Park is looking wonderful, and the new restroom is great. People are out there playing pickleball. It's being used. It's a great facility. I'm really proud of it. And one of the things that you can do, aside from actually walking across Alva Creek Paul, which is actually flowing right now, a little bit of water still going through it, you can stand there and look up that creek watershed into the back of those hills. It's really beautiful, and it'll be very tempting to you, so go look at it.
Our PowerPoint is not cooperating tonight, so thank you, Cindy.
Ongoing issue.
Okay, next we have the public safety element 4D, or section 4D. We do start with the overview as well as the resiliency approach. And then generally under safety, we have natural hazards, coastal hazards, and emergency response. Some of those include a lot of different things, so happy to get into the details there. This is where the bulk of the sea level rise issue is addressed in the plan. And then we have the goals and policies, as well as the implementation in Section 5. Happy to hear your thoughts.
So on page 484, figure PS2, with the fire hazard severity zones and responsibility areas, So Black Hill, is that the city's responsibility or the state's? Because it's a state park. I was interested to see that it was not
a very high severity zone or even moderate, because I hike in there and it's full of dead trees. Have you seen it? And they piled up the brush and said they're going to do controlled burns that never happen. And that stuff backs right onto those neighborhoods. I mean, if I were the houses right along that edge there, I would sure be doing a better job of buffering. I mean, a lot of them have hedges and things that, to me, that looks like Oakland Hills waiting to go up.
So we don't create these mapping designations. They're created by the state.
Okay.
We do apply policies that would apply to development in those areas, mm-hmm. For housing development, any development really that's on the fringe there when it runs right up against these lands that are sort of undeveloped, mm-hmm. in that type of thing. So, like for housing, you know, we don't allow you to have open eaves. You have to have enclosed eaves and that type of thing. So, and the specialized venting and that type of thing. So if there were a fire the ashes and stuff, mm-hmm. can get blown into your vents, and light, that's what usually happens, is light the inside, mm-hmm. of your house on fire, in the attic where you can't see it until, mm-hmm. it's too late. So we do implement those type of places. Our fire department places those types, mm-hmm. of conditions on projects that are adjacent to those areas, even though they're not specifically identified as high or very high hazard areas.
So can our fire department go into Black Hill and take care of some of that, or is it the state?
The state.
Wow.
I mean, they would go in there and fight a fire if we had one. But, mm-hmm. Right now, and the state has a plan. They're dealing with all of that. They've been burning it over time. They brought in equipment to do burns. They just had a lot of...
They've had a lot of fires.
They waited a long time.
Yeah.
And then they have a lot of dead, dying trees. And so, mm-hmm. it's been a process they've been going through for the last 3 years, since 2015. To get rid of them and burn them. And you had a lot of in the rookery area, a lot of those trees, mm-hmm. died because of, so there was that whole area that had, you know, it still needs stuff to be taken out of it, mm-hmm. but they don't like to do it because there are cormorants that roost,
right.
there, so it's transitioned anyway, so parents to those stuff, so.
And then Morro Bay's entire coastline is at high risk for liquefaction, with the exception of the area near Morro Rock. That was interesting to me, since all that road out to Morro Rock is fill. Mm-hmm. So what makes that less likely to liquefy?
Filled with rock.
In an earthquake?
Filled with rock, maybe.
Well, but that's a whole matter.
Yeah, the rock itself.
I mean, the rock itself is obviously not probably going to go anywhere. But
it's just
okay.
The,
all right. So
I think that's the only area that's
gotcha.
Is the rock itself.
Okay.
And then there are, when we walked.
Wow. And the whole rest
there are
of
a few other areas that are not fill along the waterfront.
Sorry, we're gone.
I guess so.
Yeah, we're all liquefying.
What was that, Amy?
Page. There are a few other areas called out as low, kind of along the Embarcadero, mm-hmm. and one that's near Beach Street, I believe, and. Those are areas that were not filled because they were already, mm-hmm. rocky outcrops, I guess, and, you know, before the fill happened. And coincidentally, a couple of those are not part of the state tidelands area because they were not filled. So, little known fact until I worked on this project.
Well, it's interesting because you don't think of, like, the the whole, you know, downtown, the southern part of town areas being high potential. But then on the excavations that I've been part of, you go down deep enough and there's masses of abalone shells that were used as fill.
And even before the 20th century fill, are saying, and it is probably a higher potential area for things to move around because it's... the coast,
right?
This substrate,
yeah.
That is.
I mean,
naturally.
Even the creek has moved a number of times, and
so we can't just blame it on on man.
Yeah.
And back, that was back to when I was talking about the cost prohibitive logic on the historical status of these buildings downtown. Liquefaction is going to want to be in the major design factors, mm-hmm. to achieve seismic. Compliance on that, and it's going to be cost prohibitive, mm-hmm. to go up. The further up you go, you know, the more the liquefaction has a bearing on what you're doing.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Anybody else have stuff on public safety?
Where's the flooding stuff? Hang on a second.
Oh, I had a question, and I think I asked it once before. There was some talk about the areas that were high risk with sea level rise, and certainly Highway 1 between Cayucas and Morro Bay, and seems like there are certain things we might be able to do or be allowed to do, but I wondered how much the state would be involved with that, you know, whether Caltrans, I mean, and is it something we should be planning ahead for, just go ahead and relocate that before the disaster happens?
We're thinking of the bridge that was studied under the specific sea level rise adaptation report, so that's definitely an area that's highlighted, and there are some implementation actions in here to continue that work to figure out what the city's preference is, and that would be a
and can we get decision-making grants?
Process, and then to work with any other agencies that are involved, including Caltrans.
Clearly, Caltrans.
Because that seems like an expensive project for the city.
You know, a priority moving forward.
Okay.
Did you see that article? On the Antarctica's the rate of melting is three times what they calculated since 2012, so it's going to raise all the sea levels. You know, despite the naysayers that say there's no climate change.
That's a good segue to remind you also that the last task of that final grant that is part of this project from the Coastal Commission is to update the sea level rise modeling, and that is happening right now. So we'll see what that yields. That extreme scenario is part of that update.
Yeah, it seems like it's a moving target. I mean, you're going to update to whatever data you have, but it's continues to get worse, not better.
It's been the issue all along. We keep getting, you know, information that numbers that we're supposed to use, and that's when we ran the first model.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the OPC, was Ocean Protection Council, was supposed to come out with new numbers, and then they've been delaying coming. They delayed because science was coming fast and furious, suggesting that the numbers were not adequate and that we were not adequately addressing how fast the sea level was actually rising. Finally, they did come out with some additional numbers, and so we're basing it on that. But I think that's going to be continue to be the case the more and more we study it as a global community. That's the thing. What's happening right now is you're getting science coming from all corners now, whereas in the beginning, it wasn't necessarily coming from everywhere, but now everybody's paying attention to it and realizing, wow, this could have dramatic impacts. And so at least all coastal regions are looking at it for sure, and it's a global issue, not just, you know, one affecting isolated areas. So I think that's part of it. The more science you get out there, hopefully the better it is, and you know, and the more we know. But I think it's going to continue to be a moving target for a while, because I don't know that we know exactly what's going to happen. We're going to do our best to model it, and then our best to apply, you know, those models to what happens in Morro Bay, and then to provide policies that address what might happen down the road as sea level rises. And we might have to tweak that. Our policies in here have us re-looking at sea level rise over time, because we realize that. That's what this document does. It realizes, hey, we don't know everything, and we don't know what we don't know, and so we want to make sure we're touching base and re-looking at those issues over time.
And I think that the other documents we've looked at talk about trigger points in this analysis, which I think will be really important. I mean, because things can happen so fast. If something breaks off our Antarctic shelf, which we can't anticipate, no one can predict, but it could make a dramatic difference in a hurry. So I'm glad it's in here, and I think it's important for
absolutely.
And that article I was talking about in Nature came out yesterday. They talked about the improved data they have is because of the increased satellites have been put up into orbit to monitor those things that they didn't have just even a few years ago. So
so just one real small point of information. Somebody in the past couple of days told me that certain areas of our Morro Creek floodplain down near where the wastewater treatment plant is have been taken out of the floodplain.
Oh, that was the commercial. Wasn't that commercial thing we talked about last
time? Well, I think they're referring to the Hansen site specifically. Have anybody else heard that?
I don't know that we've taken anything out of it recently. What you do is you do a flood analysis, you do a flood analysis on a given piece of property to determine, because FEMA flood maps are generalized and it'll cover a whole area, but topography isn't all at the same level. I mean, high points and low points in any given area. And so you might have something that comes in that's identified in a floodplain, but the level of that land is actually higher. And so you can do that study and take a look at it and say, oh, no, it's actually out of it, so it doesn't end up being in it. That's one of the ways you do it. Other ways that it can happen is you go in and you can fill an area and take it out of it, and that's another process that you can go through. So it just depends. I mean, I'm not aware that anything's okay. been taken out recently.
Does the city, do you have topo maps that deal with that area, like at 1 foot intervals, like really fine detail?
I don't know that we have it at that fine grain. I mean, we have.
This is off topic. I'm apologizing.
I'm trying to think. I mean, we have. I know there's LIDAR data available, and that's pretty accurate through that area. I think the last one that was flown was like 2016. I'm sorry, I haven't looked at this in a while, no. So it's...
Wasn't that what we talked about last time, where there was just a very small part of the site that was potentially higher than the rest, and that very small piece was zoned, you know, potentially that way, but that the rest of it was still in the tsunami area?
That's mostly how it looks.
I think it was that.
It mentioned being out of the floodplain, and then because we're not subject to, at least in this area, likely large tsunamis out of this tsunami inundation zone as well. So there is some area that's there that would accommodate some type of development.
I imagine it'd be fair to say that with respect to rising sea levels, any kind of remediation is really beyond the city's capacity to accomplish because of the enormous expense of these things. We would almost certainly be relying on state or federal. Is that?
Well, I mean, I think the idea is in the plan, you identify, you know, solutions over time. Like if you're starting to have beach erosion, sand replenishment to maintain the beaches is important. If you can maintain the beaches, then it's not eroding over to the houses that are on Beachcomber, right? And so they're not subject to it. And if we start experiencing those types of things, then you're not, you know, we got to pay attention to what we're doing with houses over there. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the areas that are in the lower lying portions of town that can be affected as sea level rises higher. And so you have to look at what we're allowing as redevelopment takes place. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. You want to redevelop and tear down the house and build a new one, but it's going to be 50 feet back from where you're at, maybe, or something along those lines. It just depends. There are things like that that can take place. Mm-hmm. Certainly, that's the idea for the Coastal Commission, is that we're looking at what's happening there and then. They prefer the soft solutions and manage retreat and those types of things versus building seawalls, right, and those types of things, which have, you know, other effects. They're not fantastic, so right. Remove beaches and things like that.
Yeah, if the entire Embarcadero needed to be raised, that would probably be a much
that's,
bigger effort.
That's what I was thinking of. And, like, you know, I'm just stating the obvious, but the scale of the problem in high-density population areas is going to be so enormous that I'm afraid the global sea rise is going to overwhelm other parts, move, and...
Old Town is going to be...
Yeah, but I think we can be a lot more adaptive than some of those other areas that are more densely populated. Southern California,
what are you going to do?
Yeah, where are you going to go?
Some of the things Miami is doing right now are...
Yeah.
That's interesting to follow.
Yeah.
Very expensive.
I had a question about the sort of following up on Susan's point on the geologic and seismic hazards on 491 for PS 210. If so much of the city is in a high risk area, then what does it mean to say that require that new development is located in a manner that will minimize risk to life and property? What does that mean?
Engineering.
Okay, so it's not so much of a location.
Building code takes care of a lot of this.
Okay, well, that's what I thought, but I couldn't. It seemed to me that they were talking about locating things in a different place. Well, if the whole city practically is in this, you know, situation, what are you talking
it's
about?
It's really just making sure you're paying attention to the hazards that you have out there, that when we're building houses, that we're getting soils reports that are identifying what the soil condition is so that you don't have problems. I mean, we have some of the more strict, you know, seismic requirements, you know, in the nation, right, because we have earthquakes here.
Okay, so...
And so it's it's dealing with a lot of those things. I think a lot of it is covered through the building code, and you have to identify your seismic area when you submit your application for a building permit to build new
So when it says located in a manner that will minimize risk to life and property, it's not so much located as built in a manner, constructed in or designed in a way that will minimize that. Is that more what we're talking about?
It can mean both.
For landslides, located could be more appropriate.
But we can
come to constructed and located.
Well, and then this one says liquefaction landslide. So I guess landslide. But even then, a piece of property is usually just a, you know, I mean, you can't move it over here, over there. You don't usually have a lot of.
It depends. So, like, I mean, our next planning commission meeting, we're going to be taking this panorama tank demo project. That property there, if there is ever a permit issued to demo the tanks, would accommodate. It's zoned residential, so it would accommodate homes. And that area of town has, at least on the slopes, that are up out of that site's mostly been worked over and graded and everything else. But when you get the slopes behind it, that's where we have some of the slope stability issues. Mm-hmm. And they'll be putting houses right on top of one of those. Or if you're doing some, massive engineering to make sure they're okay. That's caissons and grade beams or large retaining walls, removing the area, and supporting, depending on what you're doing. It could be all of those things. Just depending on what's going on there. So you can engineer a lot. It just all takes money. Mm-hmm. But you can do things to address those concerns. Or you don't develop in that area. That area is not okay. You have to develop and focus your area on the other portion of the site because that has slope stability issues.
I think for large pieces of property, that would make some sense. For the majority of the lots inside the city, they're really small. And so that's why I was a little confused. How are you going to relocate something in a, 5,000 square foot lot that somehow is going to reduce your risk of this?
Well, I think you want to, where possible, avoid things like that as opposed to engineering through them.
So on that same page, PS 2.11 building retrofits, I would suggest that encourage should be replaced with require.
So this, I think, stems from our existing policy. This extends from our existing policy. I think doesn't say that right. I think this is from our existing policy. We still have a few unreinforced masonry buildings in town. File in the building inspector's office has them in there. Simon was one of them. He spent a lot of money retrofitting them. Basically, you're building a building on the inside of a building.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not cheap. That's a lot, man.
And the rest of those items say require is the first word, and that's the only one that says encourage.
It's because we're being nice to the property owners.
So
building code's going to require.
They're supposed to be brought up, and when you touch those buildings, you have to bring them up. And then if you have one, you're supposed to have a sign on it that notices that it's not. This city has taken, I'm just going with the practice, not speaking as to why, but took taking a soft stance on requiring that to this point. That's been the practice of the city. Even in doing some of the retrofits, wasn't requiring full retrofits for a while. It was just requiring facade retrofits, parapet, tying the parapet together, those types of things. Not necessarily doing the full protection like the siren did. It's kind of what the community will bear, I suppose.
Anything else? Shall we move on to community well-being?
Okay, and Cindy noticed we have a lettering typo on the PowerPoint, so this is actually 4E.
Yes.
So, community well-being is our final element, and this is one that we decided to include based on that process of the project. It's not one of the required elements statewide. We have an overview as well as resiliency approach sections, and then the two highlighted subsections after that are community health and socioeconomic conditions. We also address economics in the economic development element, so this is specific to community well-being, a little more tailored. And I believe we have more than one key issue. We have environmental equity as a key issue. Oh, yes. Quality of life, diverse multi-generational community, chronic disease and health effects of climate change. And we have goals and policies related to those issues. Happy to hear your thoughts on this one.
I found a few surprising things in here. I was really surprised that San Luis County was ranked highly for clinical care, because I think we all kind of know if you get sick in this county, you probably ought to go somewhere else for treatment. So, I mean, I guess we have lots of doctors and we have some hospitals, but I'm not. That was interesting to me. I was really surprised to read that our access to healthy fresh food in the city was low, because I feel like all of our grocery stores make a real effort to get the local produce in, and we have a health food store, and we have two farmers markets, and so I mean, I know we don't have a lot of roadside stands maybe, but I was curious about that. I don't, you know, where is our access poor in that?
We'll definitely look into both of those. I don't
know
the answer off the top of my head.
Okay.
Under my experience.
And I guess, don't we have at least one community garden that we should be referencing somewhere?
Yeah, there is a community garden up by Del Mar Park.
Mm-hmm.
My experience, actually, as far as medical care goes, is that this is a very desirable place to live, and you have people who, doctors who relocate from more populous areas sometimes for lifestyle reasons, and I've not had any problem with quality for that reason.
I agree, though, people I know, that there are a lot of people who leave the area to get certain
mm-hmm.
types of care, and
mm-hmm.
I've heard that in other places, so we'll definitely look
well,
into
and that
that.
The cost of living is so high that often doctors...
And the reimbursement rate is not that good.
Yes, and that's the other
because
thing.
Because we're considered an agricultural, rural area. Yeah,
so our Medicare
that's
reimbursements are very low. So, I mean, and I don't know that that
is it
makes a difference in anything. It was just sort
yeah.
of interesting.
I wonder if it's worse than anywhere else where you don't have a large population. You know, I mean, is it...
That's one thing I've learned recently
mm-hmm.
is...
Yeah.
Certain specialties, there just aren't enough people.
There's not. You need
problem.
A critical mass
right.
of people.
But I think I also have heard of, and again, this is anecdotal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
People feeling like they need to go somewhere else to get the you know better level of care in the specialty.
And yeah, look into that whole fresh food thing because I that surprised me.
We're
but yeah, well, I feel like I don't know. We have. Local grocers who really make that effort to buy from local people and bring that in.
And we have two farmers markets in
right.
town, and Los Osos is
mm-hmm.
just a couple of miles, and so there's really accessible.
Yeah, some fresh products from Cal Poly and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
as well,
there's
so.
That's
and Whole Foods with stores in St. Louis. It just seems like there's
like
a lot of places to get good food.
I do like policy CW 2.6 on page 4120. Home care options increase the availability of home care and assisted living opportunities for older and disabled adults. And of course, I would love to see us have a space somewhere for a larger assisted living facility or a kind of a retirement community that has some of those. Medical and other support systems along with it. I've seen some really great models for that that I think as we have our aging community who want to stay here to have the opportunity to downsize a little into an area that is manageable and that frees up other housing as well. But I don't know where we put it. I always thought Tri-W's, but I've heard that was zoned for something else.
I think that's a high-density area. Is there a federal government?
Yeah.
Well, it's another plug for converting more of those garages to, you know, accessory dwelling units.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that, too. I mean, there's...
Yeah.
I bring that up, but we should really market that
mm-hmm.
concept. I don't know how many people know about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I have a question. page 4118, there's a table, quality of life indicators.
Mm-hmm.
In general, I'm not sure that this is meaningful data. I don't think I would call it quality of life because somebody's supposed to be able to extrapolate to that this means something. I'm not sure it does. On one specific one, the violent crime rate, where Morro Bay is higher than the state of California, not really. It's just misleading. It's based on a simple extrapolation of data for per 100,000, and we're a town of 10,000. So I'm sure that the number is technically accurate, or I'm willing to accept that it is, but I think it's misleading. And some of these other pieces of data in here, I don't know how they reflect on our quality of life. What does it mean that we have a $51,000 household income and California has 62? I don't know what that means. Relative to what? Relative to our cost of living? And it can't reflect the fact that we really have almost a binomial distribution of income. We've got some very rich people living here, mm-hmm. and then a whole lot of people who need support. 50% of the kids in this town need meal support at school. Mm-hmm. So
I would say also the median household income is also influenced by the number of people in the household. Mm-hmm. And if you've got retired people here, people without children, that will lower potentially the household income, but not necessarily mean that they're less affluent.
I'm sorry.
But that would be for the same size household, those two statistics. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's all rolled into one number.
It's normalized for the number of people in the household?
Yes.
Oh, all right. Well, that's different then. Okay.
So
you also have a large number of retired people, though, here, and that would probably tend to
But there are different median household incomes for different household sizes, and so I believe this is for a four-person household.
Okay, I didn't realize that. Thank you.
Wow, that's really low.
But then on the next one down, extremely low income, 86% of the people. How can 86% of the people?
86% spend more than 30% of their income on housing.
Housing costs
30%. Yes, that's what that statistic is.
So extremely low income, 86%.
So 86% of people who are in the extremely low income category spend more than 30%. Oh. And then in the very low income category, which would be below 50% of the median income, would be 55%.
Wow.
So we can explain that better. If
you'd expect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but I didn't know there were that many violent crimes. I was going to ask that same.
Yeah.
So were you thinking of removing that table or just explaining it better or coming up with better indicators or what would your...
Yeah, I'm sorry. You're asking me to actually step in instead of just being a critic, do a writing.
Yeah.
Constructive criticism.
Yeah.
It is hard to do. I understand that. But I maybe That's just presenting the data more as a comparison and showing maybe how the context is different. You might even show the county, Morro Bay in California, mm-hmm. and pick some indicators that are intuitive. Some of these don't make sense to me. Maybe they do to somebody else.
So what would the action item be on that? And it does say, in general, we're better off or on par with residents throughout the state. However, improving these indicators would positively affect the lives of the city's residents. Are these indicators we can improve? Is it by making affordable housing, as Rich would say?
And that really is a good point, because mm-hmm. that what the table does then is just raise huge issues that mm-hmm. the whole plan is intended to address in pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, the one that stands out, I mean, is the one that Glenn's called this business of the higher incident of violent crime. I mean, we're talking 25% greater chance of violent crime than in the typical California city.
Well, I would think, first of all, it's per 100,000 residents, and we only have 10,000. So they'd probably obviously take it and multiply it by 10 or something like that. Sure. Also, you have a fair amount of tourists. You have a lot of people who are not counted as a population because they're they're coming through their vacations or whatever, people at bars who come in from some other place. that's going to be counted, though, against the 10,000
well,
residents that are here.
And it only takes one or two. I mean, I lived in Santa Cruz when it was the mass murder capital of the world.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it was because there was one dude out there killing people in the mountains, you know.
Well, and then you end, but you have, and when you have a small population, yeah. I just think that's, that is
yeah.
a weird.
Yeah, it skews your.
So you know, yeah. yeah.
Is there another data source? Are you
and violent crime doesn't have to be murder.
Right.
It could be that people got in a bar fight or something.
I know we looked at this. I know this came up. Mm-hmm. With the background report as well.
Okay, yeah.
So we'll look back at
yeah, I think some
information. I think maybe comparing to the county
well.
is a good idea, or at least looking uh-huh. to see how that data
yeah.
looks compared to the statewide data, or just have all three possibly.
There'll be some correspondence.
I would be surprised if we're not the only city that has this issue when the data is based on 100,000 people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So is there another data source to use for smaller
yeah. small cities?
Oftentimes the answer is no,
yeah.
unfortunately.
Sure.
Space cities,
but
I don't know, just stuff like
the
that.
Other, right, the other you know, option is to sometimes take things out if they just seem to be statistically not helpful.
Well, but again, to be true to our purpose, could we use, for example, crime stats from the county or from, you know, and see what that is, and then make a notation that the crime stats were based on San Luis Obispo County stats or Slo City, whatever, but get it, dial it into closer to who we really are. I mean, if you look at the every 2 week police blotter on Bay mm-hmm. News, which is my favorite thing to read, it's like there is no crime. I mean,
yeah.
if you pulled all the drunken publics out of there and the drugs, it would be down to one page, you know, there would be nothing.
It's
so.
A lot smaller.
Yeah.
I mean, look at last year's data.
Yeah,
right. I mean,
right.
Because it is a small sample size. It might simply just be the year that we looked at
yeah, we had a bad year.
We could literally look at it this year and it could be. Pick
there
your
was a lot of stress
smaller,
that year.
You know? Pick a good year.
Yeah.
So I think that's
really
the
year.
Point is valid. It just
well, the question is it significantly impacting people's lives here?
What is it to
live
us?
Here? And I'm not. Yeah, I don't think people. Yeah. Most people think this is a violent crime city.
No, I think it's what's the context it's provided within. It shouldn't even be in here. I mean, that's the other.
Well, this is all. This is you know. This should dictate policy. That's what this
yes.
whole thing is here for. And if it really doesn't lead you in a direction that's really right, I think that's a
good see, I would rather see something like how many public restrooms per
yeah,
expected visitors or something.
Yeah, no, and we're not basing, I mean, you know, there's no policies in here to seek to address it because I think that and I think for that, it's the reason that you say it. Why? Because it's a small sample size.
Can we just can it then?
We'll talk about it internally and see what we can do. Because we don't have any policies to address anything in here related to it, so it's not doing anything.
It's like it's not saying we're going to increase our police force. And,
you know, if you actually wanted to talk about quality of life, it might be more informative to use subjective information here. Rather than to try to pick objective data that is uninterpretable. I mean, you can think about it. I don't know if there'd be a source like that, but I know we've done some. There have been surveys done in this community that may indicate where we have. And then you'd have to get into distributions and all that statistical stuff. So ultimately, maybe you just want to not talk about it.
But I could see quality of life indicators involving how many parks we have. How many spaces for walking? How many, you know, how many doctors and dentist offices we have? I mean, because that's or how good our schools are. You know, and when Morro Bay High School was named a Blue Ribbon School, that was a big thing. You know, as you're getting your kid ready for college. So, to me, that's as a person who would go looking for a community to live in. I would want to see how good are the schools. Obviously, you know, crime rates, I suppose, but more do they have their own police and fire department? What kinds of parks and recreational activities are available? What kinds of medical facilities are available? Having the urgent care, for example, when you're 12 miles from the nearest hospital is a great thing to advertise for this town.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the availability of different kinds of medical care and even alternative medical care.
Yeah.
So,
also the population turnover. You know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Does that show there's flexibility in the housing stock? or does that show that there's, you know, instability in the housing stock? I don't know. I mean, I could, you know, I can make both arguments, but I don't. What the question is, for each of these things that are in here, these are very specific indicators. What are they actually telling you? And things like how many people move every year, I don't know if that's good or bad. I really don't know.
Well, it says here that it's shown as a positive to have low turnover.
Okay. Maybe people, you know, in the recession, people were trapped in their homes and couldn't sell them, even when there were job opportunities somewhere else. So maybe housing flexibility is a good thing, or people can move, can find apartments that are more to their, you know, better rents or whatever. I'm just saying, I could argue both sides of that one, really. Mm-hmm. You know.
Great. We'll definitely take another run at this one.
Use the community well-being study that you did. Was that going on the same time? Do you remember? Do you recall?
I don't think we use that.
Okay. I'll pull that. Look at it. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Anything else on this part? I have one sort of anecdotal thing to throw out that kind of fits in with water and with climate change and drought and everything else. But I was up in Cambria talking to a business owner up there who's been there for a long time, and she said that at least there was a year or two when they had to close their public restrooms because of the water shortage, and they brought in porta potties that did not have hand washing facilities or anything associated with them. And of course, when the weather got hot and then they were nasty, she said she felt that there was a 2-year slump in tourism following that. And there could be many other things, but I will tell you, when visitors go to a place and have an experience like that, that they're not returning. You know, they think maybe they'll come to Morro Bay. You know, but seriously, it's something to think about in terms of public restrooms, and you know, we use them with water, but do we think about other ways to provide, you know, do we do composting toilets? Do we allow those in certain kind of park areas or something? Because water's going to probably continue to be an issue.
Yeah, I mean, the water issue is a good point, but it's one of the reasons why we're doing the One Water Plan. It's
right.
To diversify the water portfolio so we don't have these constrained issues with state water.
Mm-hmm.
State water from now and to the foreseeable future is going to be somewhat unreliable.
Yep.
And whatever they end up with, you know, whatever the project ends up being that they try to get water back through the Bay Delta, the cost on that is going to be astronomical if when they're able to do that. So getting off that is important. So if the you know, water reclamation facility that we're working on now comes to fruition and we're able to use that, I think that's important.
Yeah.
Re-looking at the desal plant,
yep,
and bringing that back online is important because it's diversification. And
mm-hmm.
So I think that's where we're putting most of our eggs, is, you know, looking at that, what we should be doing and when we should be doing it. And the One Water Plan's doing is looking at all of those things and saying, hey, this is what you should do first, this is what you should do second, these are the, you know, here's the constraints, and they're evaluating all those types of things. When we're done with that plan, we'll have a better idea about where we stand with it. A little bit of an unknown right now, but I think
mm-hmm.
it's going to tell us to go do those things, and
mm-hmm.
and it'd be nice if we, you know, could diversify and get off state water sooner rather than later. But I think we're locked in for the next 15 years or so, or something like that. So,
we don't have to buy all.
And yeah, maybe it becomes a commodity that we're able to, yeah, or something. So there's opportunity there if we can get off of it, and that's
mm-hmm.
what a lot of communities are doing. They're like, let's stop pumping our wastewater out into the ocean and figure out what we can do with it. You know, the,
mm-hmm.
you know, the that's what they're doing. They're doing that in Pismo, Rio Grande. You know,
mm-hmm.
and
well, and I think if people realize the impact it could have on tourism, which is like what, a third of our city income, at least, you know, that it just becomes more important.
I'm actually happy that we're doing the One Water Plan right now to start putting us down that path, because
really
I don't think, I mean, it's from a state water standpoint, we're in a good spot because we have a lot of drought buffer on it. Mm-hmm. So even when we get zero allocation, we can get our full allocation of water. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
That's only sustainable for about a 2 or 3 year period, at which point then if it was still zero, we had this extended drought again, then maybe you don't get anything. You don't want to be in that situation. We'd be spending a whole lot of money upgrading the desal plant to provide water. I mean, that would be the, mm-hmm. the immediate probably, you know, move, I guess. So.
Okay, so Section 5, as we've been discussing, is the implementation section. There are some introductory narrative portions of introduction, as well as talking about general plan maintenance and monitoring, which sounds like it has something to do with the wharf, but actually is what is required by the state and what the city plans to do to make this continue to be a relevant document. Of course, it will age as we get closer to 2040, but there are ways to take a look and make sure that we're thinking about the plan in addition to when current, you know, developments come through. And then we have the implementing actions and tools, which is made up of the giant table, mm-hmm. starting on page 5-5. So I know we've talked quite a bit already about pieces of the table, but if there are other things that you want to focus on, now is the time.
So I was curious, on page 5-2, state law requires that every city and county in California submit an annual report on the status of its general plan and progress in its implementation to the jurisdiction's legislative body, the Governor's Office of Planning and Research, California Department of Housing and Community Development. And I'm saying that for the benefit of the public, who I'm sure is listening to this and doesn't know what we're talking about. Is this written and with the this wonderful chart in such a way that it makes it easy for department heads to just go through and say, check, check, yes, we're doing this? Or, I mean, because that could be a huge thing every single year, writing up that report. But it seems like the way this has been developed should streamline some of that.
The way it's developed with the implementation section does make it easy to go do.
Okay.
Does make it easy to report on. Because, mm-hmm. this is literally, I love implementation things and plans.
Yeah, because, and that's a nice small part.
Yeah, because what we do as a city is every year we go through goal setting processes, and maybe they're, you know, maybe over time they become 2-year goal setting processes or 3-year goal setting processes or whatever. But your goals come out of this. I mean, these are huge planning efforts. We spend a lot of money on and a lot of time. We've engaged the public, you know, all over the place as it relates to this document, and we did it for the Economic Development Strategic Plan and the Downtown Waterfront Strategic Plan, and those have implementation sections as well. And so those things all lead into what we're going to be doing for goals from here into the future, you know, until we've implemented most of those things, or we've, you know, amended the documents to change them and tell us to go do something else, because of whatever issue we need to address, you know, more globally. But that's what these things do. And so the expectation is that we start implementing these things once we adopt it. We're going to go through these, and a lot of these will become new goals for the city, for various departments, my department. And that's how we'll tick it off. We complete them, and that's what we're reporting back. We're doing this, or we're working on this, or you know, what have you. That's what the reports will look like. That's exactly what this will make it much easier. Our current general plan doesn't have a go-do list.
I got one specific thing. Page 524, C-22. I'm sorry, C-23. This is to require energy and water efficient in renovated development, and I suppose the same issue applied to new development. One thing that's missing is, and this might be somewhere else, and I just don't remember everything, but Amy will know all of it, is gray water. Mm. The use of gray water systems for irrigation and for, you know where I'm going. So is that a reasonable thing to add into this?
The Planning Commission has looked into it, and it, I think there was a desire to go down that road a little bit, but really the only real feasible gray water systems, based on the science that they have out there right now and the way that they're set up, is really, you know, related to, you know, your washing machines and things like that. It's hard to use it for other other components.
For irrigation.
You can use it for that, and even that, you know, over time can create issues depending on, you know, what you're using.
So, what your detergent is.
I've not seen ones that have been real sustainable over time. There's ability for people to come in and put these systems in. Some folks in town here have done it. I know people that have done it, and I haven't really seen very many of them. That seems to be the reporting that's coming out of, you know, the larger momentum to go do these types of systems, that they're not all that successful in the long term.
Okay.
And so I think it ends up being a technology issue, and, you know, maybe needs to involve more filtering and that type of thing. It's unclear to me. It seems that everybody had good, you know, intentions, and we came out a while ago, and that was a hot topic for a while, and it's died off because it's not been implemented well. And I think that was the desire to be very green, but not paired with the science to make it work.
So how about rooftop water capture?
You can have different types of catchment systems. Rain barrels takes water off your roof. Or you can put in cisterns in the ground. Those things are all available.
We put in a system down on Coleman Park that it would be. What I was amazed by is I think it's a 1,200 square foot roof or 1,000 square foot roof. With 1 inch of rain, it's like hundreds of gallons of water you get. And it seems like if this is an aspirational policy, why not? We need to save water. And it can be used for your own gray water system. Use it to flush your toilet. There's lots of different ways. Yeah.
So implementation action C-17 includes rainwater harvesting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good. All right.
So
thank you.
We don't have gray water in here, but we do have
okay,
gray
good.
Water.
I knew you'd know.
And this is with the economic – whoops, sorry – With the economic and environmental feasibility, I think that's important. When we were talking about other things where if you add requirements and it makes housing more expensive, you got to really balance what you're doing here. I know there's going to be a state requirement to put rooftop solar on new projects. I forgot what year that implemented, but not too long from now. And so then we were talking about a requirement to underground lines, and then we're talking about a requirement to put in gray water. And all these things are laudable objectives, absolutely. But I think then you've got to think about what the cumulative impact might be or what is really the most cost-effective thing to do. So I like the way this is stated in C-17.
On page 5-6, land use 13, the exceptions for the short-term vacation rental, what is the rationale for the 4,000 square foot unit exception? I'm just curious about that. 5-6, land use 13, land use. We're talking the very last one. I think I pretty much understand the rationale behind all the other exceptions, but the 4,000 square foot units not having the 1 year exemption. I'm just wondering how that came about, or is there any explanation?
Bed and breakfast?
Who's building a 4,000 square foot unit?
That's what I was thinking, bed and breakfast. It's a pretty large structure.
It must have.
I'm curious whether this section of implementation actions may need to be revised based on what's been going on with the short-term rental process. As a general statement. Let's see. So this one, I think it's just that they would be that would be a very different type of unit, and it would be not considered like a small residential unit. But we can look into that more, where that came from.
There would be some assumptions about what a 4,000 square foot unit would have, a certain amount of parking, would have a certain amount of land, or there may be some assumptions that go with that maybe should be more explicit rather than just the arbitrary or possibly arbitrary 4,000 square foot limit.
Not to beat a dead horse, but it might be the kind of structure where it's capable of housing a dozen or more people, and
in a neighborhood might be the sort of thing you might not want.
Well, exactly, this needs to go the other direction.
That's exactly what I thought. I was like, not sure this is it's really hit the mark. That's why I was trying to remember where it came from exactly.
Well, that's why I was saying bed and breakfast, you know. I mean, when you get that.
I think the idea of waiting until this current issue settled out a little bit to revise these would be good.
It's a good idea.
Smart. I'm not sure exactly. We're going to have to go back and look.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good comment.
There is going to be a meeting on the 20th to talk about this with Dr. Heading. And
that's at the Vets Hall or here?
It's here.
Here. Yeah.
I thought that the when I was looking at 10 and 11, the different treatment between upscale hotels and mid-priced hotels. So upscale hotels have to have... they do not have lower cost accommodations. Basically, have to provide lower cost accommodations. They will have. It's written a little strangely. They say if they don't have lower cost accommodations, well, tough. You have to do it anyway, kind of. And then the mid price one is a little bit more nebulous. It's basically saying that if you don't provide lower cost accommodations, it doesn't say that you have to do it, but it says you have to do a bunch of other stuff. Like the one hotel maybe that had seating areas outside there. Is that sort of what's intended here?
Yeah, so first of all, this is only for things in the state Tidelands area, so it's not the whole city.
Right.
Just to point that out. And this came out of our work with the Coastal Commission on the low-cost accommodations memo.
Okay,
and so, yes,
like
the idea is that higher-priced properties would have to do more to kind of mitigate for the fact that they are...
Well, I think some of these other things could be more expensive, so that the mid-price ones have the choice of just offering some lower-cost... if they had the lower-cost accommodations, they'd be out of this category, this requirement. Okay, so...
That's a good point.
Yeah, okay. No, I know, it seems like they do have the option.
The intent was that by having that range of options that doesn't include actual... real estate...
It's sort of like the in-lieu fee, you know, sort of for that.
...would likely be less expensive, but... Maybe we should be more explicit about that.
And it seems like the size of the property would have something to do with it, too. If you're a really small property, this can be a really burdensome thing. Whereas you have a very large hotel, well, a couple of rooms that they have to offer low-cost accommodations, well, it's probably not a big deal for them.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the interest on the Coastal Commission, you know, was really focused in the area along the waterfront, saying, hey, even though these are small properties with just a few rooms, these are the ones that are unique. And so that's great. You have affordable rooms all over town, and we finally agree with you that you don't have an affordable issue on accommodations. In this area, you do. And so they wanted us to put the policy in.
Yeah, it seems odd because, you know, if you don't have a lot of money, you don't necessarily expect to be on the waterfront. But if you're a couple blocks away, that probably might be okay, and you certainly be willing to take that trade-off.
It's not providing rooms to folks that can – I mean, it's the – like, hey, you called and you got one of the cheap ones. Woo! You know, I mean, you were willing to pay more, but you got one of the ones that was –
Yeah, how are they going to check your income when you make a reservation?
Exactly. It doesn't do that. It's a flawed concept.
Yeah, the whole structure was a little strange, I thought.
Yeah, but it's you know, it's how we're dealing with Coastal and the policy. Yeah.
That's really bizarre.
Yeah.
Okay.
They didn't believe that we had overall affordable rooms in town. They kind of shined us on, kind of like, yeah, whatever. And then we gave them the data, and they're like, oh.
Yeah, definitely in the off-peak times.
They're like, really?
A lot of that.
I was like, yeah, we have hotel rooms that set lots of them that are well under $100 most of the time.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, okay. So our policy in that basically just says, hey, once you get down to a room number that's around the 25%, you need to start implementing things to maintain that level. And we're like, okay, we'll do that. Mm-hmm. But they didn't initially. Yeah. All the conversations were like, okay, whatever. And then we showed it to them. They're like, oh, okay. That's when they started looking at our average daily rates, they didn't. Again, they didn't initially believe us. But we gave them the data, and they're like, all right, you're a coastal city.
Well, that's not good if we have the reputation of being, you know.
We're the cheap ones.
I mean, I guess you don't want to be too low, downscale, but, you know, you also don't want to scare people away.
Well, so exactly.
Okay.
Anything else? No?
We did good.
We've talked about those things. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
You guys did a great job on this. I appreciate all the input. And we'll be rolling it in and then carrying it forward to the Planning Commission and see where we go from there. So.
I think we are.
Not to ask you to stay longer, but we do have the glossary.
Glossary.
All right.
So are there any questions or comments on any of those?
The only thing I would want to include again, and maybe it's just verbiage, but we do list National Historic Preservation Act and National Register of Historic Places, and just because I think it can be a little confusing to somehow get the word prehistoric in there, just because we don't have a separate heading for that, and the prehistoric resources do come under SHPO's, so I think it would be appropriate just to add the word in there.
I think also the gross acreage, it says acreage, comma, gross. maybe you could put it in both places just so people can find it. If I was looking for gross acreage, I wouldn't necessarily think to look. Maybe I would if I was, after I tried a few things, but where you've got that kind of, things that are a little out of order, maybe do it that way.
Can I have a second again?
Why not? We're almost done.
So quiet and everything. I just had a couple typos when I was reading through it. On page 388, I believe the word "and" needs to be taken out before the word "implementation." I think it was the first line.
Elderly persons age 62 or older.
Okay. 388, what was that?
388. It's the first line.
First line.
Yeah, I think it says something about implementation, the word "in." So, the word "in."
No, I think that's appropriate. In implementation, action CD5 and CD6.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Implementation actions was the
second. That was just something I brought up. And then on page 4113, you have a space between one and water. That's one water. Your plan. It's not supposed to have a space. Right.
4113?
Yep. Yeah, I controlled F did, so.
Great, we appreciate
it. Yeah.
Thank you.
And then my other question is, I haven't heard anything about the California Coastal Trail. But when I read the general plan, I was really happy to see that was there. I mean, that could completely change the whole face of Morro Bay. I mean, there's
so it's planned for,
okay,
more or less, but it's something that, my understanding is it's being implemented, as opportunities arise throughout the city. So, and it also, sometimes it occurs on the beach, sometimes it occurs on a road, sometimes it occurs on a trail. So it may
serendipitously go throughout the city, connecting to Cayucas.
Right. So the coastal trail is intended to be for pedestrians and bicyclists. Uh-huh. So because, the easiest route as a through bicyclist is on the highway, but that's not a pedestrian route, so the trail could in theory be located in more than one place through Morro Bay. I think that is what we've seen in the documents so far, and that's what we're recommending in this plan. But my understanding is that the northern portion of the trail in the county has been planned for, so from Estero Bluffs to the Monterey County line, but not as much planning has occurred south of that.
So it's still
in the city of Morro Bay. So there may be future planning that occurs.
So the general plan could somehow
guide
the trail properly, so some people would be happier it not being closer to their houses or vice versa type idea.
There's definitely that detail that happens when there are actual trail facilities installed,
right.
Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to look at the North Coast Trail plan, it gets into some of that. But I think when it's at the planning level,
wow.
It doesn't get into those types of negotiations,
right.
Until there's
so
actually
it's
a facility.
A minute soon of it
that they're going to deem.
Yeah, so but one thing that's in our plan, in this plan, is the idea of the area along the Embarcadero where there's pedestrian access, that could also double as the California Coastal
the
Trail.
The actual
so
trail.
You probably
right.
saw that.
And I worked along
the
schedule.
Okay,
the
I believe
it's
all I have.
65,
okay.
74.
Thank you.
The local coastal program, I thought it was LCP was local coastal plan. Is it actually program?
So the The whole update is the program, so that includes the implementation, which is part of the zoning code update, as well as the plan, which is in the Plan Morro Bay document that we're looking at right now.
Okay, because there's local LCP, and again, I thought we were using it as local coastal plan most of the time in our documents, but this is a local coastal program is what you've got in the glossary. So I didn't know if there was some...
We'll check that.
Yeah, okay.
And what is the SLO APCD? It's not in the acronyms.
I figured air pollution
I know
control
SLO
district.
Is, and I figured it was air pollution, but what's the CD?
Control district.
And thank you. It wasn't in here. So
we'll add that.
Under SLO. Or
it's a pretty impressive piece of work, guys.
Yeah, really.
Trying to get these notes down. Okay. 4, 1, 3.
Let's go.
You have a hot date.
No.
My
neck is killing me. I just want to go.
Thanks, everyone. That's all I have. Any closing remarks?
Any closing remarks from the committee?
No, me.
Everybody did so good. Any remarks from Michael Baker said she's done. Scott, do you have anything?
I have a remark.
You've got a remark? Good.
I was trying to move. It's kind of just doesn't apply here, but last night I watched the T-Bid interview at council for the gentleman, and I was just really impressed with his suggestion of having a dedicated employee to go through the town keeping it clean like Disneyland. I just thought that just spoke volumes of what it would. Can you imagine the symbolism of that? And that person could also be a greeter, information person, whatever, and keep our trash cans from overflowing, you know, and those things go a long way.
Makes a big
difference. So I was impressed with his forward thinking.
You know, I can't resist. I once had a speaker in my classroom who's been with Disney. And he was actually, he's in charge of the big scale projects, not projects, presentations at Disney. And I believe what he said was true. The number of full-time janitorial keep the park clean employees is 14. And how do you get that entire park so clean with 14 is because they inculcate in every employee that it's also part of your responsibility to pick up trash and put it away. So what it really means is that, you know, a campaign, not just among employees, of course, but employees and the citizens of Morro Bay, everybody pitch in, do your bit, pick up the piece of litter when you see it, you know, go into your trash can when it looks like it's full.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, then I think. Did you have anything, Scott?
Just other than we're doing this again next week.
We're doing it again next week.
Module 4, though, it's the last.
Yeah, that's at the other building, right? The
it'll be at the Vets Hall.
Yeah, that's our normal meeting.
And 4 to 6, right?
4 to 6. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
All right, thank you, everybody.
Last piece of zoning.
All right.
Good job.
I got one of these now.
Made it through another one.